You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Yeah, good morning. I'd like to welcome you to the 21st Annual Wall Street Comes to Washington Conference. I'm Paul Ginsberg. I'm director of the Center for Health Policy at Brookings and director of public policy at the USC Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics. Many years ago, shortly after beginning the Center for Studying Health System Change site visit studies on changes in financing and delivery of care, I perceived how poorly informed policymakers were about what was happening on the ground in healthcare markets. I also perceived that Wall Street analysts were conducting their own research on these issues to inform their investor clients, and that policymakers also could benefit from the analysts' broader market perspective. So after convening a meeting with analysts in New York to discuss market developments, I invited them the next year to come to Washington to have these discussions in front of a policy audience. Now this annual conference has exceeded the lifetime of the center and has moved with me to USC and now also to Brookings. So I'm delighted that the Jane Koskinas Ted Giovannis Foundation for Health and Policy recognizes the value of the conference by sponsoring the event for its fourth year. Through research and projects like this conference, the JKTG Foundation hopes to foster discussion about cost reduction, expanding access to care, and improving quality. The conference's main purpose is to give the Washington health policy community insights into market developments that are relevant to policy through a different source of information, equity analysts who advise investors about which publicly traded companies will do well and which ones will not. Along with a thorough understanding of healthcare markets and the companies they follow, all three of our analysts today closely follow public policy because the implications for publicly traded companies are so profound. They likely will have comments about the market responses to policies expected from the Trump administration and the Congress, comments which may be helpful to those crafting these policies. So the format of our meeting will be a roundtable discussion based on a series of questions that have been shared with the panelists in advance. We'll have two opportunities for questions from the audience, the first before we take a break at 10:30, and the second before we adjourn at noon. Note that the analysts are not permitted by their employers to answer questions about the outlook for specific companies. And a transcript and the webcast of this conference will be available through the Brookings and the JKTG Foundation websites later this week. And before you leave today, we'd appreciate it if you could take a moment to fill out the evaluation, the pink paper on your seat, and leave it on the table outside the room. We have a terrific panel this morning. They're all veterans of this conference, have done very well in the past. Matt Borsch of Goldman Sachs, Anna Gupta of Leerink Partners, and Cheryl Skolnick of Mizuho Securities. You have their bios in your materials that you picked up. So I want to jump right into the discussion, asking a question of the analysts that's different from most of the questions I ask, which are about markets. But I thought it's a good way to get us into it. And it's really about investor reaction to the election. And I want to ask them to discuss how investors in healthcare have reacted to the election in terms of stock movements in different industry segments. And things might look different in a few weeks or months, but if investors are right, what are the actions companies might actually take in terms of a different public policy environment? Who would like to begin?
I could start here. The first thing I think is the very obvious, the Medicaid managed care organization company, Centene and Molina in particular.
Better? Okay. The Medicaid companies and the acute care hospitals saw a big sell-off. Not surprising. I think most of us would interpret this big surprise, if you will, in the elections as a likely repeal of the ACA. The replace is quite unclear. Both those sectors saw enormous tailwinds from the Affordable Care Act, the hospitals with volume and with bad debt, and the Medicaid HMOs saw a lot of volume and top line tailwinds as well. So they sold off. The Medicare HMOs also started to see a lift, probably not as obvious initially, but then they rallied quite a bit. So Humana has seen quite a move since now it's reached almost $200, from 170 or something before the election. So a huge move, an expectation that the CMS from a Republican administration would be far more lenient, would deregulate, be less harsh on risk coding intensity, benchmark payments, all of that. So we saw a rally there. And most recently, I think the diversified HMOs have also now seen a move up. We've seen United have quite a big move, reached an intra-year high, and Aetna, and even Anthem as well. And I think that's coming mostly from the expectation that there'll be a repeal of the health insurance fee, that the tax, firstly, all of the industry taxes, but benefiting the insurance industry quite a bit from tax reform specifically related to the ACA, and then broader tax reform, which is likely to drive down their tax rate and bring some tailwinds as well.
So let me jump in here. So at about 10:30, when Hillary Clinton was struggling in Virginia, I started writing my note. And at 1:30, I sent it through when it was clear that Michigan was very pink. I like pink, but I don't like what happens to my hospital stocks, and I don't like what the outlook is for the healthcare sector generally when we have this kind of an unexpected outcome. And by 4:09 a.m., I downgraded the entire sector, both hospitals, managed care, and post-acute. The problem that we face, and Anna has outlined a lot of what investors may believe or don't believe, but certainly in the first hours after the election and results were blindingly obvious to anyone with a television, it was very clear that the right answer to the question, what will happen, is we don't have the foggiest clue. And to pretend otherwise, I think, is not being fair to our investment community. We do not know. The administration hasn't been set yet. We don't even know who's running Health and Human Services. We don't know who the new administrator is for CMS. We don't know what implications new tax policy will have for healthcare. As Anna mentioned, some things may go away, some things may stay. Then we get sort of the backpedaling. Well, gee, maybe we don't want to take 20 million people's insurance away, even though they potentially, some of them voted for it. They told us they don't mind, so maybe we can take it away, or maybe we can't take it away. This is the kind of dialogue that creates tremendous underlying uncertainty. And what you're observing is the market convincing itself that everything will be fine for some sectors, or maybe not as bad. So the way I like to describe it is normally, in a normal election cycle, you would have seen the Republican Party platform around healthcare coalesce around a plan. Could have been the better way, could have been some other plan, but there would have been a platform, a group of concepts that were more than just ad hoc, well, we'll do this, maybe we'll do that, throw things on a piece of paper. So we would have had a normal distribution of outcomes around that midpoint of the distribution. One standard deviation on either side would probably have had the right answer of what our healthcare system and policy will look like in the next 4 years. But we don't have that. So in essence, what you've done is you've introduced randomness, statistical chaos, as it were. And that chaotic state is kind of, I describe it as like a colonization hex, because once you shoot that marble into the colony, it changes the color of all the other marbles around it. And that's exactly what you're seeing happening in the marketplace right now, is that once there's a notion of something that people can hang on to, it will change the perception of everything around it. But when you don't know what the shape of the distribution is, all you can do is identify what the endpoints are, because you don't know what the midpoint is, and you don't know any of the probabilities around the likely outcomes. So what we do know is it is unlikely that anything will be better than what we have today from a provider perspective, from a hospital perspective, from a Medicaid managed care perspective. So if we preserve the level of Medicaid expansion as it is today, it's probably as good as it's going to get, all right, as an example. So all we can do is measure the worst case and measure the best case and get comfortable around the worst case and the best case. And investors are starting to do that work. I had an hour-long conversation helping somebody this morning work through what's the worst case, what's the best case for hospitals, for managed care, for others. But the problem that we face here is that the ACA, as those of you who understand it know, is much more than just the coverage expansion. So we have this whole value-based payment thrust that was born out of regulations contained in the ACA and built on since then. Has that train left the station? Have payers and providers, have primary care physicians so integrated the premises of value-based care, of patient-centered care, of all of the strides we've made in that direction into their practices? If so, then companies like Optum, which is part of United Health Group, which is fundamentally built on the promise of transforming and fixing healthcare, will they continue to have this acceleration in demand, or will the new administration, for example, back off the promise to move X percentage, whatever it is going to be ultimately, of Medicare fee-for-service to value-based care? Or will Medicare fee-for-service disappear in a forest of premium support? Now you see where I'm going here. This is going to be much more than just simply block grants. Medicaid expansion, yes or no. Exchanges, yes or no. There is much more there. So what you're seeing right now is a desperate attempt to make certainty or surety out of uncertainty, when the right answer is it is tremendously, in my view, tremendously uncertain right now. But we're investors. We can't not have an opinion. We can't not have a position, although portfolio managers can avoid the sector altogether. And so we're rationalizing. And in that rationalization lies danger when we know nothing more today than we did a week ago.
Yeah, maybe just a little brief add-on to both of those good summations. So I definitely agree with Cheryl that there is a high degree of uncertainty here. No one can dispute that. Our job to a certain extent as analysts is to try to predict the future. And I think, looking at the current situation, investors are making directional bets here. They're making directional bets that we're going to see more commercial market deregulation, and that may go beyond the outlook for the individual market in the ACA exchanges and encompass areas like small group that have been pretty significantly impacted by the ACA regulations thus far. And overall, the market's saying that's a net positive. Likewise, on an incremental shift towards Medicare privatization. I think it's a stretch to use the word privatization. It could just mean faster growth for Medicare Advantage. I think the markets reached that conclusion as well, and directionally I would agree with that. And then I think where the market has thrown up its hands is on Medicaid and the Medicaid expansion. And said, we just don't know, and we can't assume that that one's necessarily safe. And so that explains the depth of the selling that you've had in the Medicaid managed care names and also within some of the hospital companies. Just finishing this off, also on antitrust policy, just incrementally that maybe antitrust policy will be a little bit more lenient under the next administration. So you saw the market shift in that direction as well, bidding up the stocks of M&A target companies, Humana and Cigna.
Can I just interrupt?
Go ahead, Cheryl.
That's an interesting point, because I used to work in antitrust, and I worked there during the Reagan administration, and I can tell you as a staff member it was impossible to get anything through the administration. I mean, you could challenge it all you wanted till you were blue in the face and it wouldn't go through. But isn't it a little bit challenging for these companies that the trial date is so soon?
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I think that's my point is incremental, not necessarily a conclusion that the landscape has changed with this election, because in theory, at least, the process should be worked out or fully worked out by the time we get to the actual change of administration. You're right, Cheryl.
I think one last one is the pharma stocks, which we didn't talk about, none of us cover, but they have seen a massive rally. There was huge concern on drug pricing, and it's very much market consensus at this point that this administration will at the very least back off on some of the drug pricing policy pressures that the Clinton administration could have been putting on these companies. So it's pharma are now the winners and the darlings, you know, Medicaid HMOs and hospitals in the doghouse. I think Medicare and the other HMOs are starting to show some nice movement up as well.
Okay, thank you. I have some questions about scenarios for what the individual health insurance market would look like under just a plain repeal of the Affordable Care Act or a repeal and replace. So if budget reconciliation is used to repeal those parts of the ACA with significant spending or revenue implications, what impact would that have on the non-group market?
Let me just, if I could take a quick stab at this, Paul. I mean, if you think about an impact where what you primarily take away are the subsidies and the individual mandate. If you take those two pieces away, you're going to have something that looks like the impact on, let's say, the New York State individual market when, I say we because I'm a New Yorker, when we went to guaranteed issue with no mandate. So you spiral downwards from the 17 million covered lives today to some significantly smaller slice of coverage that is very expensive coverage, but it is available for people who need it in an emergency.
How long will it be available?
I might disagree on that, though, a little, I think. Maybe I'm just overly optimistic about this. But, you know, I think my view is that the ACA tried to simplify two problems, or maybe three, all into one. One was about uninsurable people because of pre-existing conditions. The other was low-income folk who didn't have subsidies, and perhaps the young and healthy who thought they were so healthy they didn't need to get in. And this idealistic notion of a balanced risk pool that can be created with subsidies and a mandate, and then you can bring all of this adverse population all into one pool, I think is nirvana that no one would ever attain. Now, I'm not saying that there weren't things that could have been done differently, but I don't think we would have ever gotten there. And the notion of bringing back state high-risk pools, and I was going through the Ryan White Paper, I think it's a better way, I think that's what it's called, and they talk about the state high-risk pools. I think they say it's at least $25 billion in funding. I don't know that will quite do it, but depending on how much they fund those up by, you're at least separating out this, you know, this really adverse population and from this notion that the young and healthy would then be able to balance this out. So you take care of one problem. The second thing they're suggesting is the community rating bands go back from 3-1 to 5 yeah. to one. And in New York?
Let's hold off on that one until we finish the simple thing.
Sorry.
Okay. Just repeal. So I didn't handle replace.
Just repeal. Because I think Matt brought up the point is that reconciliation, repeal, is probably not only will lead to the people in need of the subsidies not to be uninsured, not to be able to gain insurance, but also many of the others who were already using the individual market, it's probably going to be a less useful market for them.
So I'm more of the hospital analyst here, and my colleagues are more of the managed care analysts here, so let me maybe give it from the provider side a little bit. We've had a lot of experimentation with individual insurance, and I think the New York market example that Matt gave is a very, very good one. You can try the high-risk pools, and that certainly will try to carve out, you know, those who have had continuous coverage versus not continuous coverage. And a lot of this is going to be definitional. A lot of this is going to be I would say we're almost in uncharted policy territory when we talk about some of these things. There might be some experiments from some states that might provide some good insight and information. But the fundamental thing is we had an individual market before. It didn't work. It was expensive. And there's fundamentally nothing's changed. If you repeal it in its entirety, what do you go back to? You've dismantled the individual market for all intents and purposes. You're going to have to now put it back. Yeah, in some way, shape, or form. The opportunity, when I try to do something that other than wearing black and be a little bit more, you know, optimistic about it, is that maybe we can get some more things right this time if we try to structure the individual market. But the fundamental problem you have is insurance is expensive because people who buy it are sick and companies need to stay in business. So my comment is, you know, everything that we are talking about here, even if you're talking about unfettered competition, as soon as you talk about guaranteed issue and affordability in the same sentence, you have an impossibility theorem. Doesn't matter what they do. The market won't work.
Okay, well, why don't we move on to the next question, which is, let's say we're talking about repeal and replace. And, you know, what I've heard about replace is that there should be guaranteed issue at community rates. And so the question is, you know, what else would be needed to have a viable individual insurance market?
Now I can see the ACA.
Okay.
So I think the high-risk pools, I think, are great. The community rating bands, widening the community rating bands to 5-to-1, I think makes a lot of sense. The New York market that Matt, you alluded to, has, I believe, a 2-to-1 community rating band, which is very challenging. Age is correlated with disease, so it gives insurers at least some recourse to underwrite for illness, if you will. I don't think the mandate has worked, really. You know, I don't see any evidence. From 2014 through 2016, we've had 28% of people between 18 to 34, which is the golden band, age band. We haven't seen any improvement. There are hopes, I believe, that as the individuals start to see the 2.5% hit their tax returns, you might see some improvement. But it's the carrot that works. It's not the stick. And so, yeah, the subsidies being taken away will shrink that market. But when I look back to what that market size was before the ACA, it was like 15 to 17 million or something in that range. Now we have almost 7 million in the off-exchange market and less than 10 million in the on-exchange market, 8.5 million of which are subsidized. So the market shrunk despite all these subsidies. I don't know that we can kind of reverse the whole train completely, but I don't think that, you know, the proposals out that are being put out there are that unrealistic. The market's failed, and there's a reason it's failed, and something needs to be done.
Yeah, and I'm not sure the market has shrunk because you're not counting all of the non-compliant plans that were grandfathered.
That's in the off-exchange market, though,
no.
I think. No?
No, usually what's counted in the off-exchange market is the compliant plans. So you have this whole world of grandfather and grandmother plans.
How many are those, do you remember?
I don't know.
Well, if I could just jump in, I'm the official arbiter of numbers, but I'll
sure,
try.
Sure you are, Matt. Go ahead. We rely on you. Go
right.
For it.
So the latest figure out there is 10.4 million on exchange and then 6.9 million off exchange. And of the 6.9 million, about 2 million are pre-ACA grandmothered or grandfathered policies. You put that together, that's an individual market of about 17 million. That's up from about 11 or 12 million individual market size in the pre-ACA era.
I don't think it was 11 to 12, but anyways.
And then how many of those slipped
it was in, PEDS in, or not?
Into, how many of those might have qualified for Medicaid?
How many of those?
So in the prior market, might have slipped onto Medicaid. There might
That's
be a few
right.
that you would have sure. you would have sure. substituted for Medicaid.
That's true.
Can I take a stab though at the replace? The interesting thing, this is definitely seeing the glass half full, and I definitely appreciate your perspective, Cheryl, that people are seeing what they want to see right
There's
now.
No question.
So, but let me continue and see what I want to see.
Sure.
If we see what we want to see here, What we could be on the cusp of is finally getting to a bipartisan, in essence, a bipartisan embrace of healthcare reform, because we had the partisan Affordable Care Act, and now the Republicans are inheriting that with a pledge to repeal and replace, but they will own it, and so they have to take it seriously. And what we could be looking at, I say could be looking at a restructuring where we have an individual market, including the exchanges in whatever fashion they might be renamed, where there is significantly more product flexibility so that products can be tailored to, let's say, younger and healthier populations. You retain the subsidies in some fashion, although perhaps they become tax credits. You widen the ratings bands, so you take them from 3-1, maybe 5-1, maybe it's 6-1. And then you wrap around all of that risk pools. And you just could end up with a solution there that actually enlarges the individual market from its current size of 17 million because you bring in the healthy segments of the population. And let me throw in one other metric here would be some type of requirement for continuous coverage to replace the individual mandate, along with a stricter policy for the special enrollment periods, if you were to put that all together. Now, that's asking for a lot, I recognize, and definitely seeing the glass half full, but that would be the solution that maybe how it would look.
You know, I'm reminded of something that I heard from a former Republican staffer for Senator Frist, who said, he reminds me every time that leadership changes, you know, it's a lot harder to be in leadership in Washington than it is to be out of favor. And so, you know, it is the Republicans. And that's actually the happiest I've been all day, that it's now the Republicans' problem. You wanted it. You got it. Okay, now what are you going to do? So, you know, I appreciate the effort to see this as half full, but I think we need to be pretty realistic that the challenges here that face the ACA still exist, and the solutions that I've heard so far from everyone are just variations on a theme. So it's a transfer of funds from one part of the federal treasury, from federal taxpayers in some way, shape, or form, that subsidizes the high cost of insurance for people and forcing them in some way, shape, or form to buy insurance. And I'm wondering what's going to happen to the Republican constituency when they wake up one day, if repeal actually does get, if it does actually get replaced in this way, and they realize it's exactly the same thing, only a different name. So from where I sit, I'm not making any bets about what repeal is going to look like, to tell you the truth. I'm just simply advising people that, you know, to look at the companies from the perspective of best case, worst case, and, you know, here are the plans. Figure out which one you like the best, and that's what you're going to model. But there's real danger in this because there is no guarantee that the Republicans will get it right. There's no guarantee that anyone can get it right because the fundamental problem is that the only ones who want to buy insurance are sick people. And anything that you do is going to compel this group. And what I worry about on the repeal side is you still have a very sizable portion of the House that may not go along with the leadership on any kind of moderate repeal. When you say bipartisan, I guess you can always hope, but you know, you all live around here, you all work around here. You tell me, is there any hope for bipartisanship in this new Congress that's coming up? I can't see it. So, it also doesn't matter. If anything, I'm much more worried about what is one side of the GOP going to do to the other side of the GOP, whether or not they can even get to agreement, because from a company, a business and a human perspective, we need certainty on this. We don't have a lot of time. And the one final point I'll make, and far be it for me to try to help anybody who might want to take benefits away, because I actually think it is a social problem that needs to be solved. But so that's sort of my policy stance. But I am reminded of when President Obama's administration came in 2008 with arguably political capital and a mandate, and 60 votes in the Senate, which the GOP does not now have. And it took them 2 years, a loss of the 60th vote, and reconciliation to get the damn thing done. All right? Now, if I were in the Trump administration, and believe me, I'm not volunteering. I like my job. Thank you very much. But if I were in the Trump administration, I wouldn't fritter away that time. I know they're all talking about it being complex. I all know they're all talking about it being, you know, a difficult and sensitive issue. Whatever plan they're going to come up with, it's going to be as good or as bad as any other plan because the problem is complex and difficult to solve. So pick one and get on with it. H.R. 1, first bill in the Senate. Get it in there, get it acted on, and give the market certainty again. We can deal with it if it's bad news. We can deal with it if it's good news. We can't deal with it. And business, pro-business party, cannot deal with the uncertainty. Doesn't matter what replacement is. Just give it to us.
Yeah, well, let me move on to the final question of this series, which is talk about transition. Let's say we are going to have a repeal and replace, or even, remember the president-elect using the word, modify. So whatever it is, given the uncertainty as to what's going to happen this year, 2017, 2018, are you concerned about holding the insurers who participate in the marketplaces in, or could it be a real problem if they depart during this period of uncertainty and they're not there for the replacements?
I think they've already departed. I think getting them back in is going to be next to impossible. I don't see anyone sort of raising their hand and volunteering to be shellacked a second time.
I would disagree with that. I mean, it remains to be seen, but the maybe you can put United in a separate category, but the plans that have left or are leaving, Aetna and Humana in particular, have made deliberate efforts to keep placeholders on the table. Aetna, for example, is retaining plans in the off-exchange market. As few of them as possible, to be clear, but they're retaining plans in order to have a toehold presence so that they can re-expand once they look at the situation and decide that the market is restabilized and they can make a go of it again. To be clear, unless there's some type of requirement, and I don't see this happening in the current political environment, but a requirement that say you have to be in the individual market if you're going to be in Medicare Advantage or something like that. And you have had some versions of that in certain states, but I think it takes a certain top-down regulatory environment for that to happen, and that doesn't look like the environment that we're going to be in. So you have to go the carrot, not the stick, and you have to fix the individual market or have the prospect of fixing it in a way that makes participation enticing, which doesn't necessarily mean that you get United and Humana and Aetna back fully participating for 2018, but you've got a lot of plans out there. Most of the not-for-profit blues are participating. Anthem, the largest commercial public company, is participating. Of course, Centene and Molina. So there is potentially a lot to build on. If I could, not to make one other point though about the individual market and functioning, which is, it's not necessarily the case that only sick people want to buy coverage. And I think it is instructive to look at another market where you have selection dynamics that actually work, and that would be in Medicare Part B. Because Medicare Part B is an optional program that requires a premium payment. And I think, as most of the audience knows, when you turn 65, you're automatically enrolled in traditional Medicare. You're automatically enrolled in Part A, which is free. There's no real opt-out for Part A, but you don't pay for that. Part B requires a premium payment. You're automatically enrolled in that. If you do nothing, that premium payment, which for most Americans is about $105 a month or so, is automatically deducted from your Social Security check. The reason that when people turn 65, they don't opt out of Medicare Part B and say, look, I'm a healthy 65-year-old, I'll opt back into this when I turn 73 and I need health care, is because every year Medicare Part B, if you do that, gets prohibitively more and more expensive. And so there's a requirement for continuous coverage. So you could look at something like that working in the individual market. Now, the one caveat to that is Medicare Part B, of course, is 75% subsidized by the government. So that's a key asterisk.
That's an interesting point that you raised, because even when Part D was initially rolled out, if you look at the Part D rollout as a model for what could happen, As I recall, you had an open enrollment, and if you didn't show evidence of creditable coverage, then the next year when you tried to enroll, it was really expensive. So there wasn't a mandate per se, but there sure were strict financial incentives that made it prohibitively expensive to opt out year one. Now, if you had a pension arrangement that gave you equivalent coverage, or if you had an employer-based arrangement, you had evidence of it and you were protected. But that's an interesting mechanism that could certainly be considered, that if you don't opt in, that's fine, it's your choice, but it's going to become increasingly expensive, provided that whatever subsidies you're eligible for don't cover you for that incremental premium. And you could construct some things like that. And that would be very interesting.
Yeah. Thank you. Let me move on to the next section. It's a series of questions about the ACA marketplaces. And, you know, these questions, except for the ones I have asked so far, were made up before the election, shared with the analysts. And when I went through them, there were some obvious things. There is questions on public option that I'm not going to ask. But there were a lot of questions on the ACA insurance marketplaces. My initial instinct was, you know, maybe they're not relevant anymore. But then I started thinking, well, look, this structure is going to function for at least another 2 years, since 2017 and 18. And as we've gone into before, if there's a replacement, the replacement might have some resemblances to what we have here. So in a sense, the issues are the same. So I decided that many of the questions are really just as relevant and might be extremely relevant for those newly coming into power to hear, since, I forget who said it, Mr. Trump and Republican Congress are going to own this, and they're going to have to be very careful in how they build it. So first question is, with open enrollment now in full swing, what seems different this year? What seems different this year are three developments: much larger premium increases, departures of a number of major insurers, and failures of many co-ops. This has led to discussions about market stability and affordability. So the large premium increases for 2017 appear to be strongly based on claims being larger than projected for 2016 than when those premiums were set. When the 2016 premiums were set, insurers had a full year of 2014 claims experience and some 2015 experience. But 2016 premium experiences were modest. And now, of course, we have the end of the reinsurance. That's clearly a factor. But I remember seeing lots of anecdotes from insurance executives about something happened between when the 2016 rates were set and the 2017 rates were set a year later. What were the surprises to the carriers in the experience?
I think they were twofold. Maybe there's more, but at least two major factors. One was the three R's. When they set the rates for 2016, they were expecting the risk corridors to be reimbursed in full. And October was a huge surprise in 2015. And I think that catalyzed the beginning of the end of the co-ops, if you will. That then has carried over into also we've had claims issues that had not been observed in the 2015 plan year when they were pricing for 2016. And I saw a distinct difference in the tone from all the players, including Aetna and Anthem, who's still on. But the second quarter of 2016, they were complaining heavily about increased adverse selection that they hadn't observed before. And all of a sudden, the CEOs and the management teams got extremely bearish. One of the drivers cited was the gaming of the system with dialysis companies, for example, that was steering adverse members from Medicaid into the exchange population. And so that was creating a lot of pressure on the claims. I also heard about prescription drug usage that was inordinately high, and they were not getting reimbursement from the second R, which was the risk adjuster. And so you've seen Mark Bertolini from Aetna on a soapbox on every TV show that lets him on about how the risk adjustment methodology needs to be changed as well. And then finally, going into 2017, the reinsurance, which is the only R that ever really saved these companies from enormous losses that would have been even worse than what they're seeing, is phasing out in 17. And that's been quantified as something between 6 and 9% in a rate increase, once you net it out against the fact that they don't pay into the reinsurance pool as far as the premiums go. And so all of these things combined, I think, get you to that 25% on average rate increase. And you've now seen Aetna, Humana, United, and the co-ops leaving. The risk adjusters are not collectible. The plans left behind, like the Blues and Anthem and some of the regionals, are very concerned about increased adverse selection. In fact, even the Medicaid HMOs, which have been the one bright spot in the horizon, are very concerned about risk adjustment payments not working out the way they'd like. And potentially they're hopeful, but they're also worried about adverse selection coming onto their books as well.
Maybe if I could just jump in on the outlook for the exchange enrollment. We're now in the middle of the open enrollment period, which started November 1st and ends January 31st. I think a lot of people are looking at the current administration's projection that the number of signups will increase to a material degree relative to a year ago. It's not very credible, unfortunately, given the current circumstances, because I think you've got to look at two sides, and one side, in my view, significantly outweighs the other. I mean, on the one hand, it's true that the individual mandate is now more fully phased in, and you have greater awareness of that and greater awareness of the exchanges generally without all the outreach programs that have been conducted. And perhaps with some greater level of restrictions on the special enrollment periods, there's some awareness of that as well. And that may potentially induce people to take up coverage at a greater rate. But the flip side of it is obviously to point to what everybody knows here, the significantly higher level of premium increases, the significantly reduced level of product offerings, and even within those product offerings, the significantly more narrow provider offerings, provider networks that underlie those products. And I think that those sets of things will, at the end of the day, unfortunately, significantly offset the first set of things, and you're going to see signups materially lower than you would have in the last than we did in the last open enrollment period. The one other thing that's an uncertain impact is the election outcome. Will that impact the rate of signups at all? And you could think about this one of two ways. You could say, well, maybe people are going to rush to sign up because they'd be worried that if they don't sign up, that they'll lose the opportunity to do that, and that people who've signed up for coverage will be grandfathered in somehow. Or will people say, oh, well, now that the Trump administration is coming in with the Republicans, all of this is going away anyway, I'm not going to bother. It's not clear what impact we're going to see there.
Good. Because the departures of national insurers, I want to ask you about your interpretation of what's really behind them. In a sense, is it that the marketplaces were not an attractive business environment because of policies like special enrollments, that the marketplaces are a much smaller market than they had anticipated a few years ago, or that these insurers are not well suited for the very price-conscious consumers in this market? Or a fourth one is the overall political uncertainty that has been experienced. So, you know, what's your sense of the key drivers of some of the national insurers to have departed?
Can I take a first crack at this? So first of all, it is, you take what they said. You know, let's assume that CEOs of major U.S. corporations don't routinely lie, okay? Especially not in public, which would be different, change, from what we've heard over the summer. So the statements by these companies have been pretty straightforward. The risk pool is not big enough. It's not well balanced enough. There is not enough premium that could be charged in the market to take account for that. The gaming of the system is severe. Sign up when you get sick. get treated, have, you know, big losses for the plans, and then depart. And that's not how insurance works, as those of us who, you know, understand insurance know. So that clearly was the case, and I think that's absolutely true. And I think Anna gave you a really good example of this entire thing when in her first comments about the fact that the risk pool is not well balanced, it's not large enough, the risk cannot be diversified, and it was pretty clear that that was the problem. I would take a little issue at the notion of that these companies are not well suited to compete in a price competitive environment. How do you compete in a price competitive environment when most of the people buying insurance on the exchange are subsidized and price insulated anyway? That's number one. Number two, they're not allowed to actually determine what their level of benefits is, and that's a very important tool not only to mitigate their risk but also to be price competitive. So when you mandate the benefits and you mandate guaranteed issue and you have narrow bands, something's got to give and it's going to be price. And if you can't raise the price by enough to offset the risk because the actuarial model breaks because the risk pool is ill-defined, then you have to exit the business. And I think that that's just the fundamental problem here, is that the structure of this was unrealistic. And, you know, there was one other element here. So it's not just guaranteed issue. It's the limitation on lifetime caps and the limitation on maximum out-of-pocket. You're really, you know, we said this here once before, that the ACA constructs an impossibility theorem for an actuarial model. You can't ask these guys to have unlimited risk and stay in business. You just can't. It doesn't work that way. And that's why I think the ones who have chosen to exit have had to do that. I mean, you know, there's billions of dollars of losses here that they're reporting, never mind what they've been protected by reinsurance and by other things. So I think it has nothing to do with being price competitive, because we've certainly seen them irrationally price on multiple occasions often enough.
Yeah, and I think just a couple of examples of this was Anthem was probably the only large public insurer that was very optimistic about the markets all the way through maybe the end of 2015. And then I thought I heard kind of an oops in the fourth quarter of 15 that they may have underestimated the claims and the adverse selection. They've backed off considerably. They're still saying they're losing money in 16. They're hopeful that they get to break even in 17. And, you know, most of us who even give them a little benefit of the doubt think, wow, that's a buy then. Now, of course, you know, this is pre-Trump, but most of the investors are very skeptical that they get to break even in 17. I think right now, as far as I know, Matt may have other ideas. On the Blue Cross Blue Shield side, we've seen a lot of exits. I think Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida, last I spoke to the president, he was still very bullish. But I don't know if he's changed his mind as well. Other than that, I don't think anyone is really.
Yeah, well, we had a speaker yesterday at a conference that we sponsored, a Global Mizuho Investor Conference in New York yesterday, from Blue Cross of Horizon. And it was very interesting to hear what they had to say. So right now they're actually making money. And I found that fascinating, and I didn't really have an opportunity to follow up, but I suspect it's because the New Jersey insurance market was actually somewhat functional prior to
Maybe it was more like New York, wasn't it?
I thought it was.
Yeah, I think it was already terrible.
It was already
dysfunctional.
Did I say functional?
Place.
I meant to say dysfunctional. Sorry.
So it was less dysfunctional under the ACA than it was.
Or equally dysfunctional, and you learn how to behave in a dysfunctional market. But there certainly were strategies and tactics that they've been able to pursue in the market, and pricing they've been able to get, and probably a high degree of subsidy. Having said that, you know, when presented with this notion of the impossibility theorem of guaranteed issue, unlimited risk, and some of the things that have been just the broad strokes discussed in the very early stages, which clearly are not the final formative thinking of the administration to come, they would be very nervous and likely to not expose their other members and their mutual members to those losses. They are basically saying we're out. So there's a lot at risk here. You know, good credit to the Blues for staying in, losing money and hoping for the best, but there has to be a limit. It's not, you know, they can't write a blank check of transferring income from insurance companies to the federal treasury.
It doesn't work that way. I would agree with you, Cheryl, particularly on that last point. I mean, I think you are at a precipice here, and it wouldn't take much to throw this into a tailspin
right, where,
you know, a scenario that is not all that unlikely, where enrollment is down, you know, pick a number, 20-30%. Maybe it's not that much, but that could happen. And then we get into early next year, and some of the public companies, probably before others, start to recognize that things aren't turning around and they're in fact getting worse. And then you have a snowballing of exits. And I say snowballing because there is a fear of being the last plan standing in these markets. And look, I mean, in that scenario, you'd be looking at a complete unwind. The only good news there is that because you'd be looking at a complete unwind, it would demand a solution.
And might be easier to replace in that sense. I mean, you know, just stepping back for a second, so I don't think any of us are arguing that the construct of the exchanges under the ACA was a healthy marketplace. So I don't want anybody to go away from, you know, my comments in particular saying that I'm defending the ACA and it should stay the way it is. No. What I am saying is it sort of is what we have. It's not perfect. It's not great. There are people out there who needed this coverage, who want this coverage. We agreed to take care of them. So, you know, there is something of a social contract here, but there's no question the exchanges are deeply flawed for a lot of reasons. And what surprises me more than anything else is that it took the companies as long as it did to figure that out.
Yeah.
Points. Let me move on to a few questions about the insurance mergers, and I'm talking about the large national mergers. To what extent are these proposed mergers, you know, Anthem and Cigna, Aetna, Humana, and the already approved Centene with HealthNet, a response to company-specific issues or to broader changes in healthcare financing and delivery?
I think it's a bit of both. You know, it's a bit of both. There's challenges with what we've seen under the last under the Obama administration in the last 8 years, and some clear shifts that were broader into your moniker of broader changes that have sparked this, but there are also some very company specific factors. As far as the broader changes, I think just the ACA having medical loss ratio floors, incredible tax headwinds. I mean, when you look at the P&Ls of these companies, it's just astounding to see the tax rates. And when you compare that with the rest of healthcare or otherwise, they're very unfairly being punished here. And I think that put a lot of pressure on their earning streams. They've peddled hard. The public large companies have tried to make it, but you know, you get synergies when you get to the opportunity side of that ledger. You get synergies, fixed cost synergies, clearly they'll guide to those. Medical cost synergies, which they're far more cautious about saying anything about, but it is a huge impetus for merging with one another to get more negotiating leverage at the table with the providers. So I think that's the other piece. Specifically around Aetna and Humana, and Aetna must be really salivating and hoping this trial is successful at this point under this new administration and the GOP sweep, because they did it heavily because they needed to diversify into Medicare Advantage. And Humana is the prize there. So that was clearly the impetus on, you know, in addition to all the cost advantages. As far as Anthem, it was about the employer market. They're in 14 states. They don't have a national footprint. Cigna brings them that, not perfect, but it at least gives them some independence from the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association in trying to cobble together a national network for the national accounts market. And then in the select market between 50 and 250 employees, Anthem was losing a lot of market share to Cigna and continues to, from the fully insured side to self-insured and stop loss. And I think they're looking to have a full service solution for employers of all group sizes with the, you know, with the merger with Cigna.
If I could just throw in one note on that, I mean, I would look at it maybe a little bit more simply in terms of why they merged. And I'm not disagreeing with all of the individual reasons that may have influenced the particular mergers that happened. But in general, these are for-profit companies. And in any industry with for-profit companies, the tendency is what do they want at the end of the day? The best environment for a for-profit company to be operating under is one in which it's a monopoly and it has very high barriers to entry. That's a perfect business environment. So companies left to their own devices are going to merge into that configuration until they're stopped from doing so. That's just to simplify it to its essence.
I would agree with that. You know, I'm also reminded of a couple of things that were said along the way. So I remember when the deals were announced, and not covering any of those four, I won't comment on the prospects for those companies, but I'll just make an observation. There was a notion that the Obama administration and the ACA somehow was predicated on further consolidation of the managed care sector, that it was supportive of it and that it wanted it. So you can imagine the rude awakening when the DOJ actually started to talk in terms of challenging these things. I'll just sort of move the discussion along a little bit. These companies have made some pretty cogent arguments for why they need to merge. And the other thing that you do, what's hidden here is, you know, you want to build scale because scale is more efficient in this business. It is a scale business. So you can also add that to the litany of reasons. But they've been explaining to their investors why these are mission critical things that they need to do and even take to court to challenge, to prevent the DOJ challenge. And that's obviously something that's pretty unusual to do. If they don't get to do these deals, now they have to go back and recreate themselves. And they have to deal with an investor base that says, okay, you just told us how mission critical it was that y'all merge, and now you're going to come back and tell us how mission critical it is for y'all to be independent and how great a job you're going to do. So I think this is make or break for these companies in that sense, in terms of what their thesis is, what they're going to need to have in order to succeed going forward. Probably the best thing they could do is ask the judge for a continuance until the end of January, because I suspect a new DOJ will be a whole lot more interested in hearing what they have to say.
And they fought for the scheduling hearing. They fought for it to happen at
early.
The end of 16.
Yeah, to happen early. So that may be a decision that they regret, but who knew?
Well, I'm sure we talked about these mergers a year ago. And, as a result of a year and a half of consideration of these mergers, is there anything that's clear to you about the impact on healthcare purchasers and providers of these mergers?
Well, I think providers, I do believe it's going to give them more negotiating leverage. I think that's a very taboo thing to say, and obviously all of the provider lobbies and associations that send millions of letters to every state attorney general and the DOJ didn't do it, just because they were trying to help the Department of Justice. So that's where I think this goes on the provider side. On the other hand, I guess, you got to look at it in context of the value-based care trends, which we've all talked about, and not sure whether and to what extent this new administration and Congress will foster that. But a larger company, and maybe across Medicare and commercial, particularly with Aetna and Humana, I think you could bring some of these principles through CMS into the commercial arena, and conversely as well from commercial back to Medicare. So I think there's some value add there potentially for the providers partnering with companies that have a more diversified and a larger book of business at scale. As far as the purchasers, I think they will be under pressure to put some of those savings back through to employers and to consumers. And you still have medical loss ratio floors, so they are capped in terms of their medical underwriting margins. And as far as I can see, the bill HR 3762 does not repeal the medical loss ratio floor. So most likely it looks like they're here to stay. So, I would think that there's some value for the customers in the deals as well. But, they're going to let a lot of it fall to the bottom line. And obviously we as analysts have baked that into our estimates of those deals close.
Good. Next questions. This is about leverage between health plans, providers, pharmaceutical companies. Is there a trend in whether plans or providers are gaining or losing leverage?
So there's an interesting development with Tenet and Humana, for example, being at odds. Tenet is out of network with Humana right now in Florida, actually, I think nationally, but certainly in Florida. And, you know, it's going to hit their volume, and they've got a pretty smart managed care negotiator who was raised and trained at United Health Group, so he certainly learned the tough and rough way to handle these negotiations, because United tends to be tough and rough with the hospitals. And, you know, we'll have to see how that works. So if that's a sign of the times, you know, it's one data point. I would say that these are never easy negotiations with the hospitals. I think there are issues around the hospitals acquired a lot of physician practices for a variety of reasons. And they have been trying to get, you know, their hospital managed care pricing for their hospitalist and hospital employed physicians for these new groups, and the health plans have been trying, you know, it's just a step up, it's just an increase in margin for the hospital, and the health plans have been trying to push hard and back against that, and so the hospitals haven't always succeeded. I would say, you know, there hasn't been any real evidence of a change in tone, but the tone hasn't been conciliatory for a long time on the hospital side. What I think is going to be really interesting, and where there's going to be more of a battleground, because there's already been a lot of finger pointing, has been on the issue of pharma pricing for, like, the EpiPen is sort of the classic case of this, where there's a lot of finger pointing back between the, not so much the health plan per se, but the PBM. And that dynamic of, you know, the lack of transparency of how PBMs make their money versus the very great transparency of how big pharmaceutical company margins are is going to be a bit of a battleground, I think, going forward. As the PBM contracts begin to shift from we're making money off of rebates and we're making money off of spreads to perhaps some other value-added services that they can define, and, you know, it's not all about price, then perhaps that conversation can change a little bit. But that's an area that I think we need to watch. I would suggest that pharmaceutical companies understand that the pricing issue that went away was the headline and Twitter issue. The fundamental pricing issue that when you and I go to the pharmacy, because formularies have changed, because our out-of-pocket costs have risen under these new formularies as the health plans are trying on behalf of employers who are their customers, as the PBMs are trying to control the total spend for their customer, the employer, we are paying more of our drug costs and we're seeing more of this very high costs and increases. And so because that's a consumer-driven item, that's probably not going to go away as a topic, and it's probably not going to go away as a pressure for the pharma companies. On the flip side, though, there is some talk about increased support of research and development, so the biotech companies are happy, the spec pharma companies are confused, but they're still feeling the pricing pressure. And the PBMs are probably going to have to look at being a little bit more transparent. Do they have to give up margin or not? We'll have to see. But I think because this has nothing to do with which administration is running things, this is a constituent services, hand in the pocket, pull out the wallet, pay the money issue. I think it's going to continue to be an issue for everyone in the system, from the health plan to the PBM to the pharma manufacturer, the distributor, all the way down to the consumer.
I want to follow up on the PBM. You know, it's always struck me that the fact that some major insurers have their own PBM, you know, and they are going to make rather than buy those services, implies some really serious problems in the whole nature of contracting between plans and PBMs. Does anyone have any more thoughts about, you know, how this PBM relationship, you know, as intermediaries between the plans and the manufacturers might evolve?
So is the question about captive versus standalone PBMs, or whether an insurer should have a captive PBM
well, not so
and
much
the drivers?
In a sense, it's, you know, why do they have captive PBMs? I've always thought that was, you know, not a sense that making it was cheaper than buying it, but because it was so difficult to have a contract with PBMs that they had confidence in. And, you know, when you look at the Anthem suing Express Scripts on that.
Well, let me take a crack at that. I think, you know, just back to a very fundamental high-level principle, why does managed care exist? They exist, and it's been reinforced by this administration to moderate healthcare costs. And they've been doing that for hospitals, and at least in the last several years, it's been going quite well on the you know, the outpatient inpatient side. I think in the ideal state, they would like to be that intermediary entirely for the pharmaceutical side as well, and tried to do that. You know, in 2006-07, when Ron Williams was CEO of Aetna, he had a very strong vision of having a vertically integrated PBM within the company, and I think the whole notion of outsourcing would have been anathema at the time. What happened, though, unfortunately for the insurance companies, is they lag considerably in scale on the number of adjusted scripts compared to a CVS or an Express Script. So the kind of discounts that they get with the pharma manufacturers is severely disadvantaged, and they could never quite succeed with you know, with that kind of a scale disadvantage. They had issues with their script filling, their mail order facilities, to the point that even their employer medical benefits contracts were getting threatened because there was quality issues in terms of how the script filling and so on and how that went. So Anthem was the first, and it was just a complete reversal of the kind of, you know, the vision of having a captive PBM in 2009. They, I think, also had sanctions, if I remember right, in Medicare on their Part D, and they outsourced the whole thing in a very big way to Express. And that took, it took some time for Cigna and Aetna to come to the same conclusion. They're definitely more along the lines of, you know, what I would call retain the brain and outsource the brawn. So they have the formularies largely in-house. The customer servicing is in-house. But they're outsourcing the discounts because they're trying to play catch-up, and they can't, they cannot live at that kind of a disadvantage. And they're outsourcing, in some cases, Aetna is on the mail order side, and Cigna still hasn't done that. The world has changed since then, you know, and I think now we have the plans have had more script fills, particularly United and Humana, who have an organic source of script growth with Medicare Part D, and United showed this. They finally got to a point where they had adequate scale to get decent discounts, then did the Catamaran acquisition and successfully brought a full service PBM, not just to service their own book of business, but third party. And that's created, I think, PBM envy, captive PBM envy in you know, the rest of the book. I think Aetna and Anthem would clearly like to do something different, hoping the deal's closed so that their script fills and their volume gets substantially expanded, particularly Aetna, where Humana has the Part D, I mean, 450 million scripts or something, which just enormously gives them you know, a scale advantage. The other thing that happened, I think, is that the specialty drug trend overtook all the small on the small molecule side, on the branded side. And finally, the plans now, I think, feel that with physician networks, they have specialist networks where they have an advantage, and they could do something different. And they're beginning to deliver that, and Optum is showing that, and Anthem is showing that, despite the fact that they outsourced their PBM, at least as far as the more commoditized functions, to Express.
So can I just, a couple things. First of all, I'm going to, Anna, you are lucky that you're not as old as I am, so you won't remember this.
You may be surprised.
I'm old. In the late 1990s, I believe it was 1998, United Healthcare, as it was known at the time, sold Diversify Pharmacy Services, its PBM, and exited the business. So they actually had it and got rid of it. Not quite sure why. And when they did the Pacific Care acquisition, they had a small company, Prescription Solutions, that was doing the Medicare Advantage, which actually one of their leaders, a female executive, fought tooth and nail to convince them to keep. And why is it so important? I'm going to take a little bit of a different tack on this. If you want to look at fixing the healthcare system, you have to be patient-centered. And if you're going to be patient-centered, you cannot leave off the single most frequent interaction with the healthcare system a patient has, which is at the pharmacist's desk, from your consideration of the total 360-degree look at the patient. And by integrating the pharmacy and the pharmacy data real-time, synchronized, and I hate the way that words get used, but completely integrated, and they have this massive data lake where everything, they know everything, and it's all buried down there. But pulled it all together so that when you have a patient who all of a sudden pops up as being, wait a minute, this patient actually could be really sick, or this patient actually, why is that patient on that drug? It's not just drug interactions, but more than that. Then you can intervene to make sure that that patient's getting the health care they really need. And that's where the real cost savings comes from. So if you're thinking about this far into the future, assuming that not just value-based care, but transforming the healthcare system so that you're focused on doing the right thing at the right time, in the right setting, for the right reason, at the right cost, you can't just have a piece of pharmacy there and a piece of primary care there and a piece of acute care there and expect the managed care company to be able to manage all of those pieces simultaneously. If they're really going to manage care, it has to all be integrated. And I think that's the vision that United has that the others may or may not have. But if you don't have all the pieces and they're not already integrated and sitting on top of the same data and the same technology and the same analytics and the same ability to predict that someone who's on this drug is going to have that disease, you're not going to be as far along. You're going to be playing catch-up. And I think that's the actual risk of the distraction of these mergers, is that these companies are going to end up playing catch-up to where other things equal, assuming that the election results don't change anything, where United's trying to drag the market kicking and screaming.
Yeah, so you're saying that with an external PBM, you just cannot have that level of
integration. You can't be as tight. It's not just the formulary. It's the active care management that matters.
If I could just jump in for a second, though, I mean, I think there, you know, the question that you're posing here is, you know, is there a role for smaller plans? You know, can smaller plans be viable in the current environment? And I think, you know, we don't know. The answer is probably they can, and particularly integrated plans. We're talking about integration, but, you know, plans that are integrated on a smaller, more local scale, will they continue to have a role? You know, the Geisinger's, I was going to say Group Health of Puget Sound, but they were bought by Kaiser. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have the scale to run their own PBMs. Mm-hmm. Now, they can run some of those functions. So they have to rely on virtual integration. So I wouldn't disagree with your point about integration, but, you know, they need to rely on virtual integration, and they need an intermediary to contract with. And they may want and demand that that intermediary not be an Optum, that it be an entity that's independent of being a plan that's competing against them. We'll see. This is, you know, the lines
are being... That's been the argument about Optum for a while, that they wouldn't be able to succeed because they were owned by United. But meanwhile, you know, it's an 80-some-odd billion-dollar company. A significant portion of that is outside, and the outside business is growing. But there will always be people who will never trust someone who is owned by the competitor.
Right. I will say PBM is potentially... we'll see. This is being tested right now, and I'm not going to try to rush the conclusion, but PBM is a different category from some other services that it may be that health plans are less willing to buy that from a competitor than they are when it comes to other services that are maybe more distant from the core function. So I guess what I'm suggesting is what we're seeing is a bifurcation here where the largest managed care companies are inevitably going to running the PBMs in-house, but that there's a whole other segment of the industry, which, you know, unless it washes away, is going to be relying on virtual integration. And the good news for virtual integration is that every day, as technology gets stronger and stronger, you can do more and more of that virtually without necessarily having everything in-house.
Good. Let me move on to one more topic before we go for our questions and break. This is about spending trends. You know, we've had years of relatively low spending trends, particularly in Medicare, and that's triggered debate about the importance of the recession and the slow recovery versus other factors that may prove more durable. So from your perspective, what are the key factors behind the last few years of relatively low spending trends?
I think the biggest one in 2008 after the recession is, and now it all seems so obvious and we hardly talk about it, is the adoption of of high deductible plans. There was not a big trend at that time, and there's been a huge increase in penetration, and that's driven down utilization. It continues to. I think there's more opportunity to increase penetration, even though maybe the size of the deductible may not increase that much now that potentially, you know, the Cadillac tax has been at least delayed and very likely will get repealed even before the whole Trump thing happened. I think on the other side, and this year has been a big kind of a it seems like, and maybe Cheryl and Matt have, of a different perspective. But my sense when I talk to the hospital companies in the last few months is that they're all of a sudden waking up to this notion of lower cost sites of service, and it's beginning to hit their volumes. I think it was masked by the Affordable Care Act. They had a lot of volume from Medicaid expansion and exchanges, and it was hard to tell, is this the ACA or is this something else? And after the ACA tapered off, now they're talking about mix shifting, not just from hospital inpatient to hospital outpatient, but heavily to freestanding ambulatory surgery centers. And, you know, Optum is building out these regional kind of compacts around a primary care delivery system with urgent care and with freestanding ASC and owning hospice, anything that's not hospital related. And so that mix shifting is leading to a lower effective unit price equation, and it's moderating the spending trends as well. And then the third one, I think, is the whole notion of value-based care, which I think is probably more in the nascent stages, in the early stages. But you are seeing a move from fee-for-service to fee-for-value, and that's also driving different behavior on the provider side. And remains to be seen if CMMI survives in its current incarnation and what the new regime is likely to do. But it feels like on that, the train's left the station, and with the more fiscally conservative policies that we'll see, I don't think that we're going to see much of a pullback on that as well. So, you know, all of those things together make me optimistic that spending trends will remain moderated, that it is structural, that it is not purely a cyclical phenomenon. We are seeing a bit of a rebound from just pent-up demand, particularly in the orthopedic side, hips and knees. But a lot of those procedures are taking place in an ambulatory setting, which is like 25% of the cost of an inpatient, 50% or so of an outpatient setting. When I look at the Tenet P&L, which has an inpatient arm and the outpatient on the hospital side and an ambulatory arm with the recent JV they did with United Surgical Partners, it's so clear that even though they do well and the strategy makes sense, it's going to take a while before the cannibalization of their higher priced business will work itself through that P&L and they'll actually see some growth in EBITDA.
So there's a couple of interesting things, and I don't really disagree with anything that Anna said, but let me just give you a couple of things. So first of all, it's called Optum Care, and it's built around primary care practices predominantly, and it is all about patient-centered care. It's all about right care, right time, right place, right reason, right cost, at the right price, rather. And it is expected to be one of the single biggest contributors to United Health Group's Optum business over time. And the doctors are all in. And not everybody who applies to become an Optum Care physician actually gets in, which I think is kind of interesting because you have to be willing to change the way you practice medicine, which, you know, if you want to talk about bending that cost curve, that's how you do it. So that's part one. Part two is I'd like you all to pay attention, for those of you who are kind of metrics driven. Look at what's happening to ER visits and the rate of growth for the publicly traded companies and for hospitals. The emergency room is known as the front door of the hospital. Between 60 and 70% of admissions actually start in the emergency room. You roll in and you end up in a bed. 60 to 70% of the beds are filled with those ER patients. So obviously when those ER patients are no-pay patients, when they're uninsured, it hurts your P&L. When they're insured, it helps your P&L. Just back to that original conversation we were having. So just keep that in mind. What we're actually seeing and what we saw in the fourth quarter of 2013 was really interesting. Remember, fourth quarter 2013, for the last quarter before ACA enrollment started, was that the growth rate for several of the public companies in their ER visits, same store year over year, was negative. So it dropped. And then you did. You had this ACA spike, and it's absolutely blindingly obvious. If you plot it out, it just goes straight up and comes straight down, and it's very narrow over a period of roughly, you know, 8 quarters, maybe 9. And then second quarter of this year, third quarter of this year, already reported, you started to see a very precipitous slowdown in the rate of growth of ER visits. And the companies are attributing this to freestanding emergency rooms. But if you look at who's doing freestanding emergency rooms, there's a public company called Adeptus who's had to change their strategy because our good friends at Managed Care realized they were being price gouged and they're not going to be paid for these things unless they're attached to an emergency room, unless they're attached to a hospital, and they're certainly not going to pay those prices. So I find it a little bit hard to believe that this rate of growth is because of competition. I think this is the canary in the coal mine. And the one reason that I'm optimistic for our society from a healthcare perspective is that if we are really moving to this model of right care and avoiding the emergency room, because we don't need to be in the emergency room unless it's an emergency, that the hospital model is changing very dramatically. So since 2006, I've had this theory I've called starvation in the land of plenty, which is lots of old people, no money to pay for it. We are there. And in addition, now what we're seeing is the structural change of where we are being treated as technology, as philosophy, as policy coalesce around less inpatient, where you get sick, where you're exposed to infection, where the care is challenged oftentimes. These are not necessarily efficiently run operations versus outpatient, go home. So it's very clear that, you know, we need to watch. This could be the start of some very significant declines in utilization in one of the highest cost settings. That's point number one. Point number two, post-acute. So Kindred recently reported their earnings. They operate in facilities in the post-acute setting, plus they bought a major home health company a couple of years ago to try to offer an integrated post-acute continuum to deal with bundling from CJR. And they're exiting the nursing home industry, provided their landlord Ventas will let them, and they're letting them, but they have to sell some facilities to get there, and that might not be so easy. So what we're already seeing is the utilization of high-cost settings is declining, and that's very, very important, and I think that's a sea change. So I'm optimistic from it from that perspective. And the final thing I'll say is this is actually a bipartisan issue. And while that might be a little surprising, just think about the budget equation. Per capita spending times the number of capitas. You can't make per capita spending zero. You might try, but you can't make it zero. So even though it's coming down because we're being smarter about where we're spending our dollars, and also don't forget sequestration and a lot of other things that caused it to come down, but fundamentally, the number of capitas is going to rise so quickly into that part of the population. This is the same story you've all heard. Baby boomers like me, we're going to take all the rest of you for a ride, and we're going to spend your money, okay? Because we're all going to be sick, and I'm doing my best to get there, okay? I got to get some benefit. So the only way we're going to be able to handle this is the per capita spending. And you can't make price zero, so that means you must attack utilization. It's got to be smart. It's got to be precise where we get our treatment. It's got to be effective. So watch all of this business about doing these joints outpatient, because if you look at the readmission rates from the outpatient joints, your total cost of care may actually be a lot higher. So we need to move from per event fee for service to episode of care. And that's what we're doing, and where we're doing it, we're successfully seeing the compression of spending per capita.
Matt?
Yeah, no, let me just chime in a little bit. First of all, Cheryl, I think I agree with what both of you said directionally. I think you're a little bit overly optimistic.
You had to be there.
What's your meaning, Matt?
So let me just speak up for the cyclical side of this, which I definitely agree that all of these secular themes are at work here, but the cyclical side of it is important too. And I think it's important to look at some of the broad trends and the model that we followed, which originally I think was developed by Milliman, is one in which we find healthcare spending slowing for a period of 3 to 5 years in the wake of each recession. If you look back 30 years, 40 years even, you can see actually a remarkably strong statistically significant relationship along those lines with the regression model. And, you know, so exemplified by trend bottoming in 1986 after the 1982 recession, bottoming in 1996 after the 91 recession, and less dramatically, but I think still the case, bottoming in 2006, 2007, 2006, I suppose, after the 2001-2002 slowdown. And then finally, you know, and the large companies agree with this view, that trend on a per capita basis, leaving aside the ACA, bottomed in 2013 following the 2008 mm-hmm. recession. Now, why is this? Is this, you know, just some wild coincidence? I mean, you think about the delayed and lagged responses by employer purchasers. As you go into a recession, first of all, you don't, employers often aren't aware that they are in a recession until it's over or nearly over. And in the context of that, they're feeling significant bottom line pressure. They look to cut costs across every category. Employee benefits is something that they attack using whatever happens to be the cost containment mechanisms du jour. So 25 years ago, that would have been managed care. Today, it still is, but cost sharing has you know, taken its place maybe as the key mechanism. And all of that, when employers step on the accelerator to put these cost-containing mechanisms in place, it has a multi-year lag and a multi-year flow-through, and that combines with the cycle of the weakened and then recovering consumer and helps explain why you have these multi-year lags. And we think we're seeing that play through again today, though not necessarily with a big resurgence on the other end of it.
Thank you. We've got a few minutes of questions before our break. Please wait till the microphone comes to you. And yes, sir.
Sergey Kostev, Financial University, Moscow, Russia. I have two very short questions. First, are any state exchanges which are doing well, for instance, California maybe? And if yes, could those states enact their own exchanges if Obamacare gets repealed? Thanks.
Yeah, California is doing better than the other exchanges, no doubt. I think Peter Lee is, you know, and as you all know, done a very good job and is the poster child for how you can get an exchange like this up and running. They've done a good job of bringing in the sick and healthy. I believe they did not allow the grandmothering of the non-compliant plans, which helped them with a more balanced risk pool. So they are an example of an exchange that, you know, that maybe then the Republicans need to consider, is that the, you know, is that the model for what the others could be. You all are the DC folk, and obviously we've been trying to get intelligence from what might happen. And one of the things I've heard is that Republican governors who apply for 1332 waivers may get more, may be given the flexibility to try things on their own. Now, you know, however, if you repeal all of the funding sources and just defund the ACA, which it appears the dry run reconciliation bill did across all the consumer and the industry fees and taxes and the dish cuts to the hospitals, and how do you fund it? You know, that I think becomes the question. But is it possible that they could work? Maybe.
Yeah, next question. Yes, Mike.
Thanks, Paul. Mike Miller, I'm a health policy physician and actually lived here and then in Massachusetts during Romney Care, when in fact then moved back here, and actually pre-ACA had trouble getting insurance back here because the market had changed. So I want to follow up on his question and say, was it possible if everything rolls back from the ACA to our prior world, pre-ACA, that other states may look around and say, we don't like the new world and want to try and replicate what Massachusetts had done in Romney Care beyond just the exchanges, and which in theory they didn't need the more money that the ACA put into it.
They just needed the stable finance funding that they had.
They had, There were, obviously it would be blue states with that are more wealthy, but creating more divisions.
This is an interesting thought. So just how hands off will the federal government be under GOP control of both houses and the White House? And it's a really interesting question. I mean, the whole theory about Medicaid block grants, for example, is, hey, it's a state, the whole health care is local. Give all the power to the states, let them decide. They know their people, they understand their markets better than we do. The federal government shouldn't be mandating. So, I mean, that's why I think Matt and I kind of looked at each other, and Anna was the only one of us brave enough to answer that last question, by the way, you'll notice, is because I think the right answer is we don't know. It is possible, but we don't know. And you know, it depends how much internal consistency the sort of states can do everything on their own if we just sort of give them something to work with, how much internal consistency there is in that policy in the administration. And there is no way of knowing that now.
Yeah. Time for one more question. Yes, Alice. Someone bring the mic to her.
Thank you. Alice Rivlin, Brookings. There's been very little discussion of Medicare, except for Part D. But it's obviously a much bigger deal. In my opinion, Mr. Trump stayed away from it very wisely. Medicare can only give you trouble if you're saying you're going to reform it in a campaign, and he didn't. But Paul Ryan has. And even after the election, has says we're coming back to Medicare reform, by which he means premium support. How much is that a wild card if we actually get into a political fight about Medicare? What does that do to the things you've been talking about?
Let me try. Let me just give a try to that. I think. My first reaction is I think that's going to end up that the Medicare privatization is going to take back burner because we already have the Medicare Advantage program in place. And so to the extent policymakers and the Republican side can do things to accelerate the growth of Medicare Advantage, and some of that may just mean a Trump administration, how a Trump administration sits on top of rate regulation for Medicare Advantage over the next 4 years. But it might also include things like, for example, a suggestion that the policy be changed that when you turn 65, instead of automatically going into traditional Medicare, you're auto-assigned into a Medicare Advantage plan. That might sound controversial, but of course, that would be something that anyone could simply opt out of if they didn't like that. But that presumably would have a pretty significant impact. I think, though, the reason that maybe it won't be front burner is because Medicare as a fiscal problem, while, you know, certainly it is a fiscal, faces a fiscal crisis, the sense of crisis has abated to some degree over the last, you know, call it 6 years because of the unexpected slowdown in Medicare spending trend. And so I think that's a reason why you're probably not going to see Medicare be the focus of healthcare policy changes. Now, you know, could easily be proven wrong.
So I'll take it. So that may very well be true, and I'm not arguing or disputing, but if it is a focus. So let's take the if it's a focus, since we're all speculating here because we don't know. So I see a couple of really significant issues here. First of all, one thing that, you know, was mentioned earlier on in the year and that I think is really problematic is this whole structure of the call notice and the benchmarking and the complicated way in which Medicare Advantage rates are set. And I would love to see a simplification of that process just because I don't understand a word of that letter and I have to spend a lot of time trying to understand a word of that letter. And you know, complicated things tend to not work especially efficiently. So decoupling Medicare Advantage from fee-for-service rates might actually liberate and make it an alternative payment mechanism, might liberate it from both a policy and a functional perspective in a good way. Second, I would say, so I actually believe that, you know, if it is the third rail, and if you don't need to touch it, you shouldn't. But there is a significant risk for hospitals and potentially for managed care plans that not only do you see the drive to push more people into Medicare Advantage plans, but also then realizing very shortly that you've now created a monster and your spending on MA is high, you now need to contract that spending. And the more you decouple it from the benchmarking, the easier it is to do that, the simpler you make it to slash. So I would actually be in favor of it to a limited extent, but seeing that as a possibility. Now, from a provider perspective, just give you some numbers. So for a couple of the publicly traded companies, they're kind enough to give us a revenue per inpatient admission by payer type. And managed care, commercial managed care, of course, and this is not acuity adjusted, this is raw, so it's maybe not fair. But with that proviso, you know, commercial managed care is your best payer. They're going to pay you on average between, for the public companies, between $13,000 and $18,000 a case. Let's just call it, you know, $15,000 or $16,000 a case on average. And then fee-for-service is going to pay you $13,000, and then Medicare Advantage is going to pay you $11,000. So if you take about a $2,000 difference, and it's a sliding scale wherever you start, you know, Medicare Advantage will be on average about $2,000 less. That's a combination of acuity and pricing. And as a result of that, you know, if you just switch those people over, they'll come to your hospital less frequently because they're going to be kept out of the emergency room. They're going to be redirected. They might have better primary care. They might not, but they might. And so they may be lower acuity when they see you, and more of what they do may be outpatient because you've got an interventionist, a managed care plan. Bottom line is, for every number of those capitas that shifts from MA, from fee-for-service to MA, you lose $2,000. It's all margin. So it's a very challenging outlook to shift, to continue this shift to MA for the provider side alone. Never mind the managed care side, but providers all the way down the line, it's very challenging.
It's actually positive, I think, for managed care if you have a lot of Medicare. And the volume swell will just dwarf any rate pressures that you might have. And the fixed cost leverage that you get will at least keep your margin stable, if not expanding. It's just like the most humongous bull case for Humana. None of us will believe it's happening. I think we're all kind of bidding the stock up on the expectation that we'll have a more kinder and, you know, kinder and gentler CMS, but I think it's just a huge bull case. And I guess, you know, to Cheryl's concern, though, about spending then getting unbridled for Medicare Advantage, I mean, isn't the point of premium support to move from a defined benefit to a defined contribution hybrid option?
That's really
right?
Scary, so. Because then you're going to have uninsured 85-year-olds. Oh, boy, I can't wait to see what hospitals do with that.
Okay. I think it's time for us to go into our break. Let's reconvene at 10:50.
Hi. Oh, hi, nice to see you. Rich, yeah, let me get you my card. Yeah, do you have a question?
Yeah.
I think the 13.5 to me seems optimistic because I think the way they're working at it, it's 9 million at the end of the year. Then I think there'll be 1 million from shifting from the off exchange market. I believe 2.5 million are eligible for subsidies. So 1 million of it is just mix shifting from off exchange to on exchange. But then HHS believes they'll get 3.5 million uninsured into the pool. And, you know, I don't think the mandate penalty increasing is going to drive up to 3.5 million. Not to mention, you have about 1.5 million people who don't have subsidies who are in jeopardy. You know, so I think S&P came up with a forecast between 10 and 11. I could kind of see 11.5 or so. Boy, if HHS gets to 13.5, kudos to them. And then it's going to become very difficult for the GOP to justify why they would be able to completely repeal these things, at least give the states a chance or something.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, yeah, that helps a lot.
Yeah. Sure thing.
Okay, I'd like to reconvene got some questions on value-based care and a number of other things that were starting to come up this morning. So I'd like to begin with two questions about Medicaid. One is about, what's your sense of how Medicaid managed care is evolving? You know, what are some of the changes in the way it's being done, if at all? Or is it very stable and it's just expanding as more states convert to it? Sure, Matt.
Well, I mean, we're at an interesting time for Medicaid managed care. Obviously, right now, the market is freaking out about whether we're going to lose the entire ACA Medicaid expansion. Leaving that aside for the moment, Medicaid managed care generally is now penetrating the high-spending, more vulnerable populations, and that's a controversial move. It's not yet fully proven that the Medicaid managed care organizations can do a good job with those populations, balancing cost containment against the need to protect the care relationships and patterns that those members are seeking. So this is where we are. And you know, whereas today, more than two-thirds, maybe three-quarters of the total Medicaid population is already in managed care, it's also true that only about 40% or so of the total Medicaid spending, federal and state dollars combined, is actually in managed care. So you have this, that mismatch is basically because of the high spending populations, dual eligibles, LTSS, that are not yet in managed care.
Thanks. And I take it we've had a few years' experience now of hospitals with the Medicaid expansions. And what is the bottom line, a big positive for hospitals?
So clearly the one source of identifiable benefit in exchange for $155 billion in cuts over 10 years to pay for it has been the Medicaid expansion impact on the hospitals. You can actually see, in looking back at hospital-by-hospital data, which I've done, the compression of results through 2013 cost report year, and then this very rapid expansion of EBITDAR and EBITDA for those hospitals in the not so much the 14 year, but in the June 15 year data. You can see it in 14. So you can go from 13 to 14, all of a sudden you see a little uptick. And from 14 to 15, you see a strong move towards profitability in Medicaid expansion states. And it's especially true in the rural hospitals, because I cover a company called Quorum, which has 38 rural hospitals, and Community Health Systems, which has 150 hospitals at the moment, and a very strong proportion of those are rural or in small cities. And you can actually see in the data for them, as well as for Tenet and other companies with a bigger relative exposure to Medicaid expansion states.
Can you silence it, please?
Thank you. That there is a very significant uptick in profitability, more so, and what's interesting is you see it in Pennsylvania. You begin to see it in 15 numbers that you didn't see in 14 numbers. So you know it's related to a Medicaid expansion because they were late to expand. If the Medicaid expansion were somehow, for example, in some of my fondest imaginations about what could happen positively here, one might argue that Medicaid block grants might give some of the states the optionality to say, well, wait a minute. If we're going to sustain the level of current spending and per capita, and the number of capitas is higher in states that are Medicaid expansion states, then states that didn't expand will get less than states that did expand. Okay, so maybe if I'm running one of those states, then wait a minute, before all this gets started, I want to make sure I get as much as I can from the federal government. Therefore, maybe I, now that it's Republican controlled, maybe it's, you should excuse the expression, kosher for us to go ahead and expand Medicaid, because now it's a Republican idea, it's going to be endorsed, and we're going to have complete control over how we do it. There's no strings attached, et cetera, et cetera. So you could actually see that benefiting the hospitals. That would be one ray of hope and light that I would sort of hand out there for the hospitals. but they very definitely have benefited from that piece in particular. The exchanges, obviously, the hospitals have benefited where the health plans have not, because they've been the beneficiary of where much of this excess cost of the adversely selected risk pool has been showing up, certainly initially showing up in the emergency room, and then, you know, to the extent that they had poor health status coming in follow-on care. But, you know, what's really interesting from a stock market perspective is before the election, reform was good for hospitals, but reform's impact was dying out. And so there was already a bear case out there for owning the hospitals, and the hospitals had already come down strongly off their highs when it became very much apparent that volume comparisons were tougher and that they weren't seeing volume growth, and that, you know, we attributed much of this to the fall-off effect of not having enough new people enrolling in the ACA-sponsored plans, be it Medicaid expansion plans or Medicaid expansion or exchange plans. And so there was already a bear case coming into this that reform wasn't good enough for hospitals. And so now you just compound it in whatever they had before, which was been 5 or 6% of their EBITDA, depending on who you were talking about, maybe a little bit more for some of the companies, will now go away as your worst case scenario. So it can put the hospitals in some pretty dire straits, like the point that Anna made, that the managed care companies have had very significant negative impact, cuts in advance of coverage, tax in advance of coverage, so have the hospitals. I mean, these groups, all the groups that were, who saw Medicare reimbursement cut, which are not just the hospitals, they're the post-acute companies, they're, you know, included in the ACA, for example, is also home health rebasing and things like that. All of them have paid for it, but the ones that have benefited most from it have been the hospitals.
Okay, let me.
Can I ask a question to Cheryl? What about, I mean, I think the DSH cuts, the DSH cuts are supposed to be, are on the docket, I should say, to be repealed as well. So what would be the net impact, you think, going back to the original, you know, DSH payments relative to not having Medicaid expansion?
You know, what was interesting was that most of the publicly traded companies did not have that much of a negative impact of DSH cuts as we looked around at what they were. And in fact, some of them, the way in which the formula for the DSH payments depended upon how many uninsured there were in the state prior versus how many uninsured, what the reduction has been, and it was tied to that. And so as a result, you know, most of the, not all, but most of the companies actually were expected to get an increase in DSH payments in the early part of the ACA, not a decrease, modest, but an increase, which was a counterintuitive outcome, but, you know, it was formulaic, and that's what happened.
Yeah. I'd like to go into the questions about alternative payment models, value payment, what we're calling it. First, I want to ask about provider perspectives on ACOs and bundled payments. You know, how eager are they to engage in these contracts? You know, what role do they see this play is going to play in the future?
So I'll take a crack at that one, since it's really actually quite interesting. So the premise of an ACO, fundamentally, if you're a hospital, is to empty out your hospital beds, because hospital care is expensive and it's not always appropriate. And so the trick was that you would see increased market share, but you would see fewer of those patients, fewer hospital days per patient of your current population, but you'd have a bigger population. And, you know, I love the argument, well, we'll make up on volume what we lose on price. It doesn't often work that way. So, you know, it's been, generally speaking, the Medicare ACOs, as we know, have not been successful for the hospital participants, but for a handful. However, what we are seeing is hospitals expressing, and provider groups, physicians as well, expressing significant interest in joining population health-based plans. Everybody was preparing for these sorts of things. It was all paid for, you know, instead of fee-for-service, it's going to be fee-for-value, it's going to be outcome-oriented, it's going to be tied to quality. And some of that's already happening, but what we're not seeing, or what we haven't seen, are these broad-based move towards population health at-risk plans being offered or negotiated by the health plans and the hospitals. That has not happened. And if you talk to some of the bigger providers out there, like HCA, they'll say to you, we would be happy to explore that if somebody would offer it to us, but, you know, no one's really offered it, and we're not going to give a discount that we haven't been asked to give. So you know, it is a bit of a challenge to see how that, you know, how the hospital driven ACOs would ever be, you know, fully accepted by hospital management teams, because it's just an anathema. It means you have to empty your beds, and that's their model. On the other hand, where we have seen a lot of ACOs being formed is between the physicians and the health plans and other provider groups and the health plans. And, you know, there are well over 750 of them around, you know, just in we'll call them well-defined, actually, ACOs. But there are many other kinds of variations on this that have been tried. It's not clear what impact they're having on utilization. It's not clear what impact they're having on changing behavior. But, you know, where there is some evidence of at-risk schemes and arrangements, they do seem to have the effect of changing provider behavior, which changes specifically physician behavior, since they, you know, are the start and they're the source of all of this. It's also changing consumer behavior, but not nearly the kind of impact that you would have expected.
I think bundling, there seems to be appetite. I wouldn't say that they're wildly enthusiastic on the public side, but, you know, Tenet and HCA seemed relatively positive. And I've talked to some of the not-for-profits. They're quite positive. They're, you know, yeah. They're saying
bundling's a difference.
Bundling's
is a different,
different.
Story.
It's not an ACO, but yeah. Bundling, I think they like. So it's the price discount off the DRG. But they think the offsets from the post-acute squeeze and an increase, a little bit of an increase in length of stay, they still end up expanding their margins. And some of them are touting that they'll be more profitable and growing faster. So we'll see.
So perhaps the rule is that what's interesting to you as a provider is an arrangement where there are other provider services that you can succeed mm-hmm. by cutting. But if it's your own services, like the hospital with the ACO, you won't do that.
Yeah, it's a zero-sum game, and I guess someone's got to get squeezed.
Actually, it's going to be a negative-sum game. So at some point, the hospitals are going to realize that their lengths of stay are going to be compromised. See, this it's not really a fair test yet, because CJR hasn't put the hospitals at risk yet. They don't go at financial risk until next year. So this is all experimentation. And they're learning, and it's nice to have a year where it's phased in, where you get to learn. But, you know, it's still fee-for-service reimbursement for each of the slivers, and then they'll figure out, you know, this amount later on, how much of a benefit or a cut you're going to get. So it's going to be an interesting, it's going to be very interesting. I will say, though, that the data that's come out from BPCI and Health Affairs was fascinating, because you didn't get the increase mm-hmm. in home health to the extent that you thought. You saw some increase in home health. You saw a very steep decrease in subacute nursing home care, but not in home health. And so the question is, where are these patients going? Are they going home with no follow-up care, or are they going home with outpatient? Can they actually drive? Are they not homebound? It's really fascinating to see how this is really changing the practice of medicine with using financial incentives, and that's what it's all about.
Good. Okay. What about... to what extent are hospitals or physician organizations, working closely with selected post-acute providers on either ACOs or bundled payment? Just want to look at the partnerships, the relationships.
So you've seen community health systems, which has a bit of a leverage problem. They're trying to significantly deleverage. Just for the record, I have an underperform rating and a $3 price target on the stock, in case you're wondering about my position on that. But to be clear, they have certain assets that they can sell and perhaps use for strategic leverage. And one of the smarter things they did was take their home health agency across their hospitals and sell 80% of it to one of the home health care companies, Almost Family. And they'll retain a 20% interest and presumably create networks. And LifePoint did much of the same thing. So they did it with LHC Group. So you are certainly seeing that. You're seeing HealthSouth owns Encompass, which is a very fine home health agency company. And they have said that they've been very successful in negotiating sort of one-on-one partnerships as being part of a post-acute network for acute care. So you are beginning to see these kinds of virtual alignments. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to matter. The star scores are going to matter. The quality is going to matter. And the readmission rates are really what's going to dictate this.
Yeah. You know, is there sufficient expertise in the post-acute sector to really do this transformation?
I think there are some really interesting things being done in post-acute from a... there are a couple of private companies that are doing some interesting things with sort of whole patient care, looking at the total episode of care and intervening at the front end so that you save money at the back end. Are they really post-acute? I don't know. I call them a disruptor because they're disrupting behavior. But within the post-acute network or the post-acute companies, I think there are some business leaders get the joke. I mean, they know where this is going. They understand that you need to be able to have a much more holistic view of the patient across an entire episode of care, and that they have to, if they're going to play a role, they have to make sure that whatever status the patient comes in at, they at least get no worse. They do get better, and the bleeding in terms of the cost of their care stops for that condition. So there are some who are willing to enter into some innovative kinds of arrangements, but I don't see much in terms of what those innovative arrangements are yet. It's still very early.
I guess it would just add to that. I think what we're still experimenting with, and probably will continue to for quite a while, is, you know, what is the best model? What are the best models? If you look at a market like Southern California, a lot of this is driven by primary care
That's
physician
correct.
Groups.
Who
and they are the
at
real,
risk. Yeah.
Absolutely at risk. And generally, they are the integrators of care. But outside of markets where that's evolved over a long period of time, it tends to be more companies and facilities that have emerged to fill the gap, as they are the only ones with the organizational scale and risk tolerance to pursue these types of arrangements.
And that's a great observation because, you know, you see someone like Northwell Health that's pursued an awful lot of these kinds of innovations, who was at front of the curve on BPCI. Sort of the interesting factoid there is that when they had two of their hospitals were in BPCI, they're the old North Shore LIJ, and so they've now become Northwell Health with aspirations from Massachusetts to Pennsylvania to D.C., so they're coming. And what they found was that the cost savings to the system of avoiding a nursing home stay after joint replacement was so significant, with actual improvement in quality in their model, not just neutral but improvement, that they just sacrificed their own bottom line by changing their practice protocols. And unless there's extraordinary circumstances, none of their joint patients will end up in subacute.
Yes, it sounds like some of the early efforts, particularly under bundled payment, to, you know, integrate post-acute care has been not dependent on the capacity of post-acute care, because the patients just aren't going in to the facilities.
Yeah, they're emptying out pretty quickly.
Yeah. Good. One question about delivery systems that are either developing their own limited network insurance products, either own or in partnership with an insurer, for the Medicare Advantage market or for the ACA marketplaces. What's your sense of whether we're going to see a lot of success in that area, or is it really going to be quite marginal?
My view would be marginal. I think that tends to be the experience that we've seen for the few systems that tried to do that hasn't been resoundingly positive. They haven't been walking away from it like they have from exchanges, but it's a little experiment without much success. If you talk to Kaiser, you know, and then they are integrated payer providers, so it's a more balanced perspective, I'd say, of all. The president of health plans there thinks that the health systems grossly underestimate the challenges that the plan side of it have to undergo to gain membership. It's the distribution advantage and all of those things that they don't have any capabilities around, population health management, building out the networks with, you know, primary care docs that are successful, all of that, which I think a lot goes into this that is not, I think, appreciated as easily by the health systems when they walk into this.
So our former colleague, Carl McDonald, whom we all remember, I'm sure, fondly, used to say, you know, the managed care companies have been managing this risk for, what, 30 years now? And from time to time, even they spectacularly don't get it right. You can't expect hospitals to be able to manage this risk at all. That's not what they do.
Yeah, I think a consultant once told me a very concrete reason why joint ventures with insurers work better, because the insurers can get a low-price network to supplement the delivery systems network. So, but I guess it's a wish. I want to shift to the private health plan perspectives on ACOs, bundled payments. You know, how eager are the plans to pursue these types of reforms?
I think they're excited about the risk-sharing arrangements. They've been looking for this for a long time. They talked about it for years before they had got some cover, if you will, from D.C. And now the train's left the station. Every day I look, you know, Aetna or Cigna or one of them is talking about the next ACO arrangement that they're building out from a private plan perspective. And whatever I've heard so far on the bundling side as well, it sounds like they're very much chomping at the bit to, you know, to move in that direction as well and just piggyback off of all of the reform that CMS has already pushed forward.
Anna, I would mostly agree with you, but I think that the jury's still out on how supportive the managed care companies are really and truly being for these types of arrangements. I mean, they are entering into them. There's no question some of them are there aggressively pushing forward. But there's always going to be a tension when, you know, it comes down to the question of delegation and giving up roles and responsibilities. Because if you look at, you know, a delegated model like what prevails in the Southern California market, that isn't necessarily where the payers ideally want to get to if they think it through, and they may end up there. But that's a tough transition, because you talk about in a market like that, in a model like that, delegating and in a sense, you know, offloading a lot of functions that you've been doing successfully internally for a long time.
I think Optum is doing some interesting things with Optum Insight. You know, they talk about it as strategic relationships that they're building. They look at the readiness to take on risk quotient, if you will, among health systems, and then make a strategic choice around where they may partner with this health system on Optum Insights, which is their health IT platform. They may actually donate, you know, some capital as well, and then build that strategic relationship. I believe right now with North Shore LIJ, and then they have a Dignity, but they haven't been picking, they've been very selective, but, you know, it's a broad arrangement in how they're doing it. I kind of agree with Matt. I wonder about Aetna and Cigna and if this is just all, you know, PR, or is there any substance behind it? And maybe it comes more to, not that the plans don't want it, but the incentive alignment is quite minimal with hospitals that want to fill beds. So unless you can find an equation where the contract is a win-win, it's challenging to do that. On the other hand, a primary care medical home type model that Medicare Advantage has is just an obvious win-win on both sides with the primary care doc.
I'm definitely seeing a lot more innovation on the Medicare Advantage side, mm-hmm, with respect to these sorts of arrangements or at risk or changes in behavior, all of the things we've just been talking about, because the nature of that market, first of all, there's plenty of opportunity to, extract cost savings at a constant level of outcome. But also because the structure of how they're paid rewards them for improving patient experience, improving patient outcome, improving patient care, whereas in the private sector, depending on the contract you have with the employer, it may not actually reward you for that. So there's a very clear, as you go around and you talk to some of the primary care groups with Optum Care who are sort of leading in this patient-centered home kind of arrangement or any of these changes in practice patterns. I'm not even going to say it's changes in behavior. It's just changes in practice patterns. So instead of putting an end-of-life patient in the hospital, you encourage them to accept hospice. Mm-hmm. Save a lot of money, mm-hmm. Okay? But whatever it is, you're definitely seeing that more in the Medicare Advantage side, just because the savings are mm-hmm. there and the mm-hmm. quality metrics will reflect the fact that you get better satisfaction and outcome, which gets you better reimbursement, and so there's a financial incentive for both parties.
Agreed.
Yeah. What about, you know, some areas, you know, there's a very dominant private insurance plan. It's usually a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, which is going to get, has an advantage in commercial rates mm-hmm. over the other competitors. And are these people dragging their feet, or are they actually, ironically, probably in the best position to pursue this if they want to?
What's Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alabama doing?
I don't know, but I mean,
right?
This would be...
I mean, that'd be the right. question, because they're that's pretty right. dominant.
This would be a classic example of where I suspect, you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of internal angst at these plans about, you know, how much of what, you know, they've done for the last 20 years are they really, you know, willing to give up? And you know, in many cases, they may have good reason to be reticent to give up those functions because they're not necessarily things that are going to be done well when they delegate them down to the provider level. I think that I think in more cases than not, there's a real reluctance, and so the question of how long it's going to take and what changes in, you know, competitive patterns are maybe going to force that.
Yeah, the Blues, I think you know, they to your question, I think they have the advantage of actually moving such partnerships forward, perhaps a competitive advantage in that regard. However, they are resting on their laurels to some degree because they just enjoy straight discounts that are carrying them through better than the others. Also, to Cheryl's point, I think the savings are largely in Medicare, and those are much more immediate, and Blues tend to be more commercially driven, and so that reduces the incentive for them to see some, you know, to see an improvement. I'm hopeful that Anthem will do more of what I've seen a little bit of. You know, they've had a ton of leadership transition in the last 1 year and been completely distracted with all their issues with the individual market and all that. But they have started up some interesting things as far as provider partnerships on the oncology side with their physician networks to manage treatment paradigms. They've have this partnership called Vividi in Southern California with multiple providers, so very innovative things where, because of their scale, their desire to move out of being a just purely local Blues and deal, you know, just working with their discounts and mix shifting into Medicare, and they have Medicaid, that they'll do more here.
Yeah. What about the fact that half of, say, commercially insured people are in self-insured plans? And to what extent has been, you know, working with the employer to get their buy-in to this been something that has really been a restraint on private insurers in pursuing this?
Yeah, I think it's a real factor. You can't move faster than the market or your customer is willing to move. And, you know, some of these things that, you know, the health plans, it's hard to get your first large-scale customer to bite on some of these more innovative ideas or, I will say, even disruptive ideas, because you really are going to make some parts of the continuum here uncomfortable, and you'll have some complaints. But generally speaking, there are some employers out there. You might think about perhaps CalPERS. It used to be GE. Some of them have always been very innovative and very forward-thinking and willing to take that step of being the first to leap into a new benefit structure or a patient management paradigm. But I think that's absolutely correct. You're definitely limited by the willingness of your customer to be innovative. I think that as we get into, and by the way, I think your point on cyclicality is absolutely correct. We cannot forget that this is a cyclical business, and I don't forget it. I just think that the level of the cycle may be affected by the decisions we make to use or not use healthcare at a time, but that's okay. So it's, do you start here or do you start from there? In any event, the one of the things that I think we do need to take into account here is just how much these employers are screaming in pain from the cost of their health insurance bill. And the more that they find themselves unable to pull on the same levers that they did before, the more willing they are to find new levers to pull.
I mean, there are, you know, the trend in amongst employers is still towards more self-insuring. You see that happening in the middle market and even in the small group market in response to the community risk pooling rules. But at the same time, there are some signs that some of the large employers are maybe pushing a little bit in the other direction, starting to do some of the what we would have called slice contracting back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that could perhaps start to enable some of the integration of providers.
You know, when I asked the question about self-insured employers, I wasn't concerned so much about the really big ones, because those are the people that have the staffs, have the benefits consultants, you know, who can perceive the potential. But I was thinking more about just the process of going from one 500-person employer to another one. People who don't really have sophisticated benefit staffs, that, you know, what it takes to convince them to go along. And I do know that when the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, went forward with their alternative quality contracts, one of the reasons they did it only for their HMO enrollees was just because of the enormity of the task, particularly in the Blue Cross Blue Shield world, of getting the self-insured employers in, because they're talking about, you know, employers all over the country who might have employees in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What's your sense about which approaches to alternative payment are the private payers see as the their biggest areas of opportunity? You know, in a sense, you know, are they focusing on the population based or on the episodes or on the primary care approaches?
I think there's a recognition from lessons learned from the late 90s, when there was a lot of premature global capitation happening in markets with provider organizations that were ill-suited to take on that risk. And so I think payers are being pretty smart with it by and large, and they're approaching they're approaching the task in a very stepwise and, you know, graduated fashion. So more emphasis on episodes, and a slow approach to moving towards real, you know, population-based reimbursement, and only doing that with organizations that have really proven that they're willing to or that they're able to take on that that responsibility.
I think it's more primary care at this point in time. I think they're cautiously optimistic about the other alternative payment models, but there's a big focus from Optum Care to do that. You know, Humana, I think, has pulled back a bit from buying practices, but they continue to focus with Medicare Advantage on the primary care model. And so any of these changes around macro or, you know, all of the other things proposed by CMS have an impact, you know, possibly even to the positive for someone like Optum Care. If physicians feel that they are just overwhelmed with the complexity, instead of selling themselves to hospitals, then there may be more opportunity to go to a plan.
The one thing that I would just say that some of the smarter health plans have learned is they try to transform a model or intervene in a way, you know, the markets are structured, is that there is no such thing as one size fits all in healthcare, that all healthcare, like all politics, is local. And so what will work in Southern California and Las Vegas and maybe a couple of other sort of risk-capable provider markets will never work in New York, where you have very strongly independent practitioners and a lot of regulation around the behavior of for-profit entities and others, you know, so that there is a real difference, not to mention difference in population densities, and sometimes urban healthcare can be as challenging as rural healthcare can be, in the sense of, you know, you got smaller sized markets, but you have same sort of population demographics. So there's an awful lot going on that, you know, we have to be careful not to generalize too much. I think, as usual, where you see the real leadership of these alternative payment models are in not just Medicare Advantage, but in the Western states predominantly. Also, you've got some in Texas, because some of the development of Texas the Medicare and Medicaid markets in Texas actually, you know, fostered this under PacifiCare. But there is a very healthy respect among all of the providers as well who are trying to look at taking risk, for the as well as the health plans, for the nature of their local market and the task ahead of changing that behavior from a fee-for-service to a risk-based model. And there will be, you know, they're all trying to avoid the blow-ups of the past, where, you know, the provider groups failed and PacifiCare had to pay the claims twice. So there's a real live example and real live incentive here to be very focused on how fast your local market really can change and whether the population demographics are such that, including the growth rates, are such that it can support the investment that you're going to need to make in order to get these changes.
Good. One last question about narrow network plans. We've seen them being extremely important in the marketplaces. I presume that they're significant in private exchanges, but what's your sense about, you know, thinking of the totality of private health insurance? Do you expect narrow networks or just more limited networks than we have today to become very important in the future?
Well, it makes sense that you're seeing it in the individual market, and you see it to a certain extent at Medicare Advantage. I mean, as maybe is pretty clear, that when you have an individual buying or selecting a health plan, it's much easier for an individual to say, well, you know, I can choose from amongst 20 narrow network plans and pick the one that is going to work for 99% of my possible care needs, as opposed to an employer who's contracting on behalf of a geographic and otherwise diverse workforce, and is going to, you know, really only look at the capability of contracting, therefore, with a limited number of plans and have pretty broad networks. The problem here, though, is, you know, when you think about, okay, the idea behind private exchanges is breaking that open and taking the employer lives and enabling those lives to more readily select narrow network integrated plans, you've got a little bit of a chicken and an egg, or maybe a big chicken and an egg dilemma here, where, you know, the formation of lower cost narrow network integrated plans or integrated provider organizations is dependent on the critical mass of lives in things like private exchanges, selecting and buying those types of products. The flip side of it is that you're not going to get to the critical mass of those lives in private exchange-like vehicles until you already have the lower price narrow network plan options available. I mean, that's a dilemma that might seem unsolvable, but you get there bit by bit over time. But I think that's a little bit of why we're where we are now, and partly why the private exchange adoption has stalled to the degree that it has, at least relative to where expectations were at their hypiest maybe 3 years ago.
Yeah, actually, this is a good topic to get into if any of the others or Matt have more to say about private exchanges. I was going to ask you about whether they've stalled, and I guess they have. And you think that's the key reason?
I mean, I think when you look at the rationale to move to private exchanges, there are a few different reasons given. I've gone to one of them, which is not necessarily the first on the list of purchasers, purchasers might say, well, I just want to move to defined contribution and offload this responsibility for purchasing to the employee level and get it out of the role of being the paternalistic employer purchaser. That is clearly one of the roles, being able to, you know, then budget that expense on some predictable basis tied to maybe some type of escalator is another rationale. And then the last one is, you know, getting to the ability to leverage narrow network integrated plans, which I think is the most powerful of them. But, you know, all of those are really tough transitions to make, which is why I think it's been a slower process than some people had hoped a few years ago.
And the Cadillac tax is now put on the back burner until 2020, most likely gets repealed. High deductible health plans have proved to be quite effective in keeping medical cost trend down. So the need to do something as disruptive as a private exchange for a large employer, I think, and the burning platform is no longer there. So here we are with 7 million, actives. I think on the retiree side, you may continue to see more of it. And then on the small group side, I mean, there was a kind of a construct around it would help them potentially pool risk. And that might be one more impetus to build out private exchanges. I believe maybe Mercer is the one that does the more fully insured kind. Towers, I think, is more of the self-insured above 1,000 employees jumbo. But now, you know, as we look at what might happen with the election coming back to that, with association health plans is one more option that's being tabled for small group employers to pool risk and then facilitate and ease their ability to move to self-insured and stop loss, you again might see less of an incentive to go to private exchanges.
Yeah. Is there, given the sharp movement towards higher deductibles as part of benefit buy-downs, do any employers talk about running out of room to do this? Will there come a point to say, if the deductible gets even bigger, it really, it's question, why do we get into health insurance in the first place if we're really not providing access to care? Any evidence that we might be near a point where some employers just don't see this as an option anymore?
Cheryl, I see you shaking your head.
I'm not aware of anyone who's saying that. That's what I'm saying.
Well, we're hearing a little bit of that from some of the health benefit consultants who work with middle-sized employers. We're hearing of some buy-down fatigue going on, and it's somewhat correlated, perhaps, with a tighter labor market. So a little bit of backing off there. I'm not going to say that we have a characterization that that's necessarily widespread, but there's some of that going on.
So buy down fatigue as opposed to concern that the deductibles are too high.
I'm piling the two together.
Okay.
We can't go higher on the deductibles already $3,000.
Yeah,
we can't take it up to $4,000 or $5,000.
Really?
You
think so?
I think there's some of that going on. I'm not.
That would be good news. I haven't actually heard that, so I'm learning from you, which is great. Thank you. But I actually hadn't heard that. But I know that there's certainly beginning to be what I have been hearing though is beginning to be from the employee side, a fair amount of pushback. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. I don't really have health insurance. I'm self-insured for the first $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 of my family's health care costs, and it just doesn't kick in. There's beginning to be a realization, I think, on that side. So that was why I was sort of shaking my head. I'm not hearing it from employers, but maybe just because of where I sit, I tend to get that feedback more from the consumer side.
I have heard, though, that again with the Cadillac tax, and I think I mentioned this at the beginning of this panel, that their impetus to raise the size of the deductible has now become much less. There still is headroom to penetrate high deductible health plans more within their employee base. And of course, at some point, that reaches a ceiling as well. But I've heard this from some of the third party, not the benefits consultants, but like the players like Fidelity and so on, who manage benefits in kind of an infrastructure way.
Yeah, and then as someone mentioned, we we could be moving into a tighter labor market, which is something we remember from a long time ago. And we also knew what the tight labor market did in the, this was the late 90s.
We were in a full employment, internet-driven, go-go, gaga economy, the good old days of when we were all rock star analysts. Yay.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, I was, actually.
So that could be another cyclical turn that could change a lot of these things. Hospital employment of physicians. How much further will this trend go?
Oh, God, I hope not much more. hospitals are really, really not good at managing doctors. This is, you know, we've seen this story before. It didn't end well before. And honestly, the feedback, the observation one makes that LifePoint community both expressing some difficulty in, you know, achieving profitability on the acquired physician practices for different reasons, perhaps, but, you know, doctors and hospitals are fundamentally should be well suited to each other, but they're really not. There's another issue though, and it's a financial issue. So part of the reason why the hospitals were really interested in acquiring the doctor practices was they could take them from the outpatient reimbursement schedule and make them a hospital-based unit and get immediate bump up in the reimbursement from Medicare. And again, they tried to do that also with the managed care companies to greater or lesser success depending upon the market power of the players. So if the health plan had more market power, it was a no. If the hospital was a must-have hospital in the network, it was a yes. Now with them basically saying, well, wait a minute, there's sort of this site-neutral thing at the outpatient rate, and that has been finalized. I think we'll see the drive for the financial arbitrage as an incentive essentially stops. And now there's got to be a real notion of integration and coordination of care and some other clinical quality reason why perhaps you should be integrated other than just the financial engineering reason. So I suspect it's going to pretty much stop because it's nothing but losses for the hospitals. The only reason why you wouldn't want to do it is you don't want to let the health plans buy them because that's even worse.
I always thought the health plans were buying them strictly to keep them away from the hospitals.
And then make a business out of it. I mean, yeah. That's creativity at its finest.
Good. There aren't any more comments on that. We'll move on to the next topic, which is on physician consolidation. We had a conference a few weeks ago here on surprise medical billing, and one of the speakers noted how some of the hospital-based physician specialties, such as emergency physicians, have become highly consolidated into a small number of national firms. And I've seen Matt's coverage of some of them. Perhaps the others of you cover them too. And just want to comment, how extensive has consolidation become in this area, and what's been happening?
So the chief financial officer of LifePoint left his job to go be the CEO of Team Health, and 3 weeks later got acquired. I hope he got a lot of stock in it. I hope he vests. It's covered for us by Ann Hines. It's pretty significant. And I'm not sure if it says that, you know, the economics of that business are beginning to come pressured. So, again, you need to build scale, and you need to be able to offer benefits to these employed physicians that, you know, a bigger company can perhaps do. There probably are some arguments around that. And national contracting, again, may, especially if you're dealing with consolidating chains on both sides, both managed care, bilateral consolidation above and below you, managed care and other providers around you. We've certainly have seen that, and it's remains to be seen how successful that will be.
Excuse me, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, one of the interesting experiments, which hasn't worked out all that well thus far, but certainly a company to watch is DaVita and DaVita Medical Group. It's not been a good acquisition for them heretofore, but I think, you know, this is a company that was looking at the eventual, if not near-term stagnation of the dialysis business and saying, you know, what is going to be a growth engine of the future? And so they acquired Healthcare Partners, and Healthcare Partners was and is a now renamed DaVita Medical Group, an organization of primary care-led physician groups in Southern California and a handful of other markets, operating under a very advanced delegated integrated care model. And they were looking for a partner or an acquirer that was A, not a payer, B, not a hospital company, C, was large and well capitalized, and D, a healthcare company. So their list got very small, and the marriage with DaVita ended up making a lot of sense. But it's been a really tough road for them to take that model and advance it into new markets. And frequently where DaVita Medical Group has been looking at acquisitions, they find themselves outbid by the local hospital or by the payer or by both. And meanwhile, the results that that they've had for their own operations have been mixed. But that's going to be an interesting story to watch.
The other example of the consolidation in this ED space, well, ED and anesthesia is pretty fragmented, and you're seeing a lot of roll-up. The two players are Team, as Cheryl mentioned, and Envision. And so you're seeing roll-up within each of those as far as staffing of hospital physicians, and for all the reasons Cheryl mentioned. There's another company, AmSurg, mm-hmm. which is the ambulatory surgery player that bought an anesthesia company called Sheridan. And they've recently made a deal now to merge with Envision, who is the ED consolidator, if you will. And the CEO there has a vision of this conglomerate that will offer one-stop shopping across all hospital physician staffing services, ED, anesthesia, radiology, neonatal, and with their ambulatory surgery capability all rolled in. So I think, you know, that's ways for them to try to create value by offering better rates and one-stop shopping, physician training and recruitment under a corporate umbrella. Team had enormous issues, though, when they went out of their ED and anesthesia mode into buying a company called IPC, which is a hospitalist company, and have overpaid for it, have seen tremendous physician attrition in the hospitalist piece of that acquisition. And that combined with the fact that they rejected a bid from AmSurg at 50% higher stock price not that long ago then drove them into the arms of Blackstone, which is a private equity company, and they're hoping to turn all this around and bring stability to the hospitalist organization. Hopefully, I think they're hopeful that the bundling story with CJR and all that will also play out favorably for Team, but in a private setting, so that all of us analysts and investors aren't breathing down their neck. I think the CEO, as Cheryl pointed out, was very strongly incented to sell, and his employment contract, it was pretty obvious he was going to sell very quickly.
Yeah, both of you have mentioned various what I call efficiency things, value propositions. But what about the potential for just pure leverage that, consolidating nationally the ED docs is going to give them great leverage negotiating contracts with hospitals? Is this something that policymakers should be concerned about?
It's still very fragmented. I think if you look at the numbers, they're not easy numbers to come by, but I think you find that I don't think we're close to there yet. Clearly, at a certain point, the answer to that is going to be a yes. But that's, from the numbers I've seen, would seem to be still quite a few years away and a lot of consolidation away.
And ED is seeing so much, so many secular pressures, I think, with the Affordable Care Act tapering off, if not even being unraveled. Medicaid expansion lives. You may see more of a steerage from Medicaid plans away from the ED to primary care. Now that might be kind of a golden scenario, but that's a headwind as well in ED. And then the freestanding ED story, though, that one
it's hard to really, you know, sort of say whether that is bad. But all of them, in the third quarter, you saw HCA talking about freestanding ED pressures, and then team health missed yet again. And so the stocks had really tanked for a while on all these worries.
Good, thanks. I'm going to be moving to questions from the audience soon. But before I do that, I want to give each of the analysts an opportunity to either answer some question that I didn't get to that they really had something to say on, or just, you know, give other thoughts of reflecting on the discussion so far as to what the audience should take away.
I think talking about the small group market, you know, we talked a ton about the individual market, but the small group market has been facing enormous headwinds. Not to say it was ever completely functional, and you had all these employers who were slowly dropping their rate offer rates and all of that. But I think we're now to the point where the under 50 market, you have this ACA compliant market, where the companies are losing a lot of money, and there's this kind of keep what you have ACA non-compliant market, which is expected to be phased out by the end of next year. But the worry that Aetna and Anthem have, and they're probably the most exposed here, is that as these two risk pools are merged between the ACA-compliant and non-compliant books of business, that the currently non-compliant small groups who are possibly healthier and more likely healthier will not be able to withstand that risk pooling. And so you have each of them now talking about how they're going. You know, Anthem is openly, I think, pretty much saying in their earnings call that they will compromise on margin to try to retain those groups. But there's an enormous worry about what that pool risk looks like. And Aetna talking about, you know, sort of obliquely that they would be willing to lose membership to try to recover their small group margin, because their efforts to keep margins intact this year did not play out very well for Aetna. And I think it was one of the two drivers that led to them not beating numbers that, as I think, they had expected and perhaps analysts had expected at the early part of this year, the other being the individual market, which turned, you know, worse than they had hoped.
Matt or Cheryl?
Go ahead, Matt.
No, I don't have one.
You don't have one? Okay. So, first thing, yesterday when I was meeting with some of my hospital companies, they asked me to sort of sit up here among all of my managed care friendly colleagues to sort of defend the hospital sector. It's a little hard to do that right now, because I'll start by saying what I said before. We honestly do not know, let me remind you, we do not know what is going to happen. So, all of the things that we've been saying here are predicated either on the continuation of the markets as we know them today or some vision of what could happen in the future. But, you know, we come here and we're hoping through your questions to learn a little bit, or at least I am, to understand and get better insight into what is likely to happen. Because there are a couple of things the market does not tolerate well, as I mentioned. One of them is uncertainty. And the other is negative surprise, being uncertainty. And we are, they are the same thing. And we are in a position now of perhaps, you know, we're on a great precipice of great change, so that perhaps Congress can lead us in a direction where we fix the things that are wrong with the ACA, because there are many, and preserve what is good. But, you know, from where I sit, I think that it's a very risky bet. So a couple of thoughts. First of all, a very simple strategy with respect to hospitals. If reform was good for hospitals and reform is going away even before the election, it's still going away. So therefore, a lack of reform is bad for hospitals. The hospitals that I think will ultimately succeed in all of this are the ones that will be able to consolidate, and I don't mean by acquire. I mean by rationalizing the capacity that they have, because no matter what's going to happen with the ACA, you're either going to have no pay patients coming back, or you're going to have activist managed care companies who are working to manage their margin at the expense of the hospitals. One of those two things, I think, is likely to happen irrespective of the politics, because it's the economic equation at work. And if that happens, then we're going to see exits of hospitals from the marketplace. So just, that's the concern, that right care, right time, right place, that the economic incentives and the technology and the innovations in care management, the quality metrics, the readmission policy, all of these things are training primary care and other physicians to keep their patients out of the hospital as long as they can. And the ones who will survive are the ones who have to survive, not the ones who want to survive. So we could be on the precipice of very, very great change, and that might not all be bad, but very great change for the hospital sector in particular. For the post-acute sector, I think I was here last year sounding the warning bell, and I hate to be Cassandra in this, and I hate to be the one always being the voice of doom here, but maybe it's genetic and maybe it's just the 29 years in the business of just seeing things, that we said, you know, bundling is going to be very dangerous for these post-acute settings. And in fact, it's even more dangerous than we thought, even before it fully kicks in the sense that the skilled nursing facilities that were getting paid several hundred dollars per day are now no longer seeing those heads in the beds. Doesn't matter how low cost you are if the patient doesn't show up. And now when you contemplate what might happen with Medicaid block grants and what might happen with Medicaid funding overall, long-term care facilities where your mom and dads are maybe one day, or when I might be one day, if I'm nice to my kids, it'll be a good one. They may be in very dire straits, but watch the hospitals, watch the ER admissions, watch for signs of the real changes that we could possibly see on that score. And then finally, the best thing that I think could happen out of this whole policy mess that we've gotten ourselves into, not to mention the whole electoral mess, would be for a very rapid conclusion to the uncertainty, but also for this, for the folks to just look at the ACA with more objective eyes, to understand that it is not wholly bad and it is far from wholly good, but that if we focus on some of these innovations in payment for value, we could actually address what the ACA perhaps should have addressed all the way along, which was getting rid of the barriers for actually providing the right care at the right time, in the right place, for the right reason, at the right cost, which is where the healthcare system, I think, needs to go. So I'm encouraged from that perspective that perhaps the Republican leadership can get us in that direction now that they're talking about preserving at least some of the ACA, only because that's this part of the ACA that I think that actually has the opportunity to get us to a long-term better healthcare system.
Thank you. I've got time for a couple of questions. Yes, Sean.
Hi, Sean Bishop with the Commonwealth Fund. I was wondering if any of you have been looking at United Health Group's paper that they are talking to folks about. It's sort of their vision of all the things that they like, that they would like to see happen. One of the things that's in that paper is their sort of commitment to having what they're calling, I guess, entitled subsidized health insurance for the uninsured. And what they are looking for, now maybe this paper was written before the election, so maybe it's potentially moot, but we met with them after the election, so they're still talking about it, but that they want to build on the Medicaid program as a way to insure, you know, the uninsured. They don't think the exchanges function in their current form. I was wondering if you could comment on that vision.
Oh, I'll give it a crack.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay. So first of all, how much simpler would it be? Okay, you're uninsured, you're low income, forget the mechanisms and the structures of the subsidies, put everybody in a Medicaid expansion plan. You know, ideally that was part of what was supposed to happen when all 50 states were supposed to participate, but you know, from their perspective, from a social perspective, the mechanism of doing that, you don't have to build a whole new exchange mechanism, it would have been much simpler, okay? So, as one Democratic staffer once said at a conference I attended, you know, if this was really a government takeover of healthcare, if this was really single payer, it would have been so much easier. As of January 1st, 2014, you'll all be covered by Medicaid. Done. Finished. And by the way, your taxes go up. That would have been very simple. But don't forget, this is a for-profit company with a very significant portion of its business coming from Medicaid managed care. So when you do block grants or when you do an expansion of Medicaid, the Medicaid managed care companies benefit. So should they be talking their own book? As if I were a shareholder, you betcha I would want them to do that. Doesn't mean it's wrong, but just remember they will benefit from this. And I do think it would be much simpler to administer.
Okay. One more question?
I think there's one here.
There's one there. Oh, Paul, yes.
Hi, Paul Hughes, Crom with Calterum Institute. Despite the fact that we've heard for months how terrible our economy is, in a few months it'll be the third longest economic expansion in U.S. history. And when it ends, that will give all of these players opportunities to make changes that they can't make when things are going well. What kind of changes do you see happening when we get to the next recession?
Well, one thing to watch for, just if we go back to that cyclical model that we were talking about, is that historically anyway, trend is usually spiked or peaked into a recession. And, you know, that combined with the pressure on the bottom line is what then has tipped the scales for employer purchasers to take action in terms of healthcare cost containment, or at least to step on the accelerator where maybe they weren't before. I guess it's a little hard to envision, you know, what is the next step in healthcare cost containment when that becomes more urgent. More shifting into high deductible plans, narrow networks, but narrow networks aren't going to work unless there's broad, unless you have employees have a broad choice of plans to pick the one that's appropriate for them and their family. So I think, you know, it's probably going to be something around the evolution of private exchanges that is what you would see occur when we get the next, you know, urgency call around healthcare cost containment brought on by a recession.
I think you, the one thing that you omitted there is thinning of the benefit.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not just the copay and deductible, it's what's being covered. And if you get rid of the metals, as you know, think about, do we get rid of the metals plans as a, are they providing a floor for the benefits in some way, shape, or form? You know, if you're an employer and you're looking at the metals, do you have to do better than that? Or can you do just that? Or can you do less than that? But you could also see the thinning of the benefits.
Okay, well, this is a good time to, we need to close the meeting because we're approaching noon. This room has to turn over quickly for another meeting, so it asks you to do two things. If you have cups, please take them out with you, and if you want to continue discussions with other people, please do it outside the door. I want to thank the analysts for a really terrific job.